Concordia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1, Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. This month, the KPR Community Spotlight is on Prairie Paws Animal Shelter, with locations in Ottawa, Manhattan, and Emporia, providing compassionate care for animals in need, including spay and neuter programs to help reduce pet overpopulation. Details at prairiepaws.org. Support for news on KPR comes from the Lawrence Arts Center, presenting Runway and Rhythm, a designer fashion showcase and dance party. Saturday, October 4th, VIP and general admission event details at lawrencearthcenter.org. Right after the news, we'll go back 50 years for the great and one of the most influential bands in Irish music, the Bothy Band. First, this news from NPR here on Kansas Public Radio.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Authorities in Michigan say at least one person was killed when a gunman opened fire on a church this morning, which was also set on fire during the attack. The suspect was shot dead by police. Member station Mission Public Steve Carmody reports.
Police say an unidentified 40-year-old man rammed his vehicle into the front doors of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Grand Blanc, Michigan, about 60 miles north of Detroit. The man then allegedly opened fire on people attending the morning church service. Police believe he also started a fire that burned much of the church. Officials say responding officers engaged the gunman, killing him. Scott Bennett is the Grand Blanc Township supervisor.
This kind of violence doesn't happen in our community, and we are heartbroken that it came to Grand Blanc Township.
Authorities are searching a part of the church heavily damaged by fire. For NPR News, I'm Steve Carmody in Flint, Michigan.
The deadline is fast approaching to avoid a partial government shutdown. The fiscal year ends Tuesday night, and Congress has not approved the regular bills to pay for government programs. President Trump is to meet tomorrow with congressional leaders, including Democrats Senator Chuck Schumer and Congressman Hakeem Jeffries. House Speaker Mike Johnson told CNN the president doesn't want the government to shut down.
I'm telling you where his head is. He wants to bring in the leaders to come in and act like leaders and do the right thing for the American people. It's fine to have partisan debates and squabbles, but you don't hold the people hostage for their services to allow yourself political cover. And that's what Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries are doing right now.
The Democrats want a provision to extend health care subsidies for middle and low-income families that are now slated to expire this year. Gaza health officials say more than 66,000 Palestinians were killed by Israeli fire after nearly 2 years of war. At least 19 people were killed in an Israeli strike on a crowded outdoor market over the weekend. Israel says it was targeting a wanted Hamas militant. NPR's Anis Baba reports.
Israel launched a raid in central Gaza last year and rescued 4 Israeli hostages. The operation also killed at least 276 Palestinians and wounded nearly 700, according to Gaza health officials. It was one of Israel's most lethal attacks of the war. This weekend, an Israeli airstrike hit a busy market, killing 19 people, including women and children, and wounding at least 70 others, Gaza health officials say. Israel says the target was a Hamas militant allegedly involved in killing an Israeli soldier during last year's hostages rescue. In recent weeks, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have been displaced to South Gaza, where Israel says it's safer. But that area has also been bombed almost daily. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza City.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF, a national philanthropy working towards a future where health is no longer a privilege but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. Let's go back a half a century to hear the great Irish band, the Bothy Band, here on KPR. The Bathi Band, and just a terrific arrangement of a traditional tune. The Butterfly, and before that, the song Do You Love an Apple, the lead vocals of Trina DiDonno, who plays clavinet, which gave a distinctive sound to the Bathi Band. That's from their 1975 debut album, just called The Bathi Band. And I would make the argument the most influential band over the next 50 years of Irish music. Yes, they drew upon things that the Chieftains did, and then especially Planxty. In fact, Donald Lunny, who founded the Bathi Band, started out as a member of Planxty, would then leave and form the Bathi Band, with Paddy Keenan playing the pipes, Donald Lunny's bouzouki, Matt Molloy's flute, Trina and Mihal O'Donnell on harpsichord and guitar, and clavinet, too, for Trina, and fiddler Tommy Peoples, the first fiddler of many in the Bathi Band. They were only around for a little under 4 years with three studio albums, but I said they made Irish traditional music cool and were a massive influence on Irish trad music over the next and the last half century. Support for Trail Mix on KPR comes from the KU Natural History Museum, offering memberships to help support the museum's mission of studying life, past and present, to educate, engage, and inspire. Membership details at biodiversity.ku.edu. Let's move to Cape Breton for the terrific band Queeg, and here taking a song written by the American folk singer and singer-songwriter Mary McCaslin.
Sun is rising high, burning into the day. I will say goodbye, I'll be going away. Brush away my doubts, what tomorrow will hold. Feeling fine for now, going down the road to a city to see.
Heavy.
going away. Brush away my doubts. What tomorrow will hold? I'm feeling fine for now. Going down the road. Feeling fine for now. Going down the road. Feeling fine for now. Feeling fine for now. Feeling fine for now.
A terrific band from Cape Breton, Cui, which is spelled C-O-I-G, and their 2017 album, Rove, includes a lot of traditional music, but there it was a song written by the wonderful American singer, songwriter, folk singer, Mary McCaslin, called Down the Road. They first heard it via Stan Rogers, and they worked up their arrangement of it, Cui, with the twin fiddles of Christy Crowley and Rachel Davis. Rachel, one of the lead singers, as is Brent Darren McMullen, who plays, well, people call him the Swiss Army knife of Cape Breton music, various guitars, mandolins, banjos, bouzoukis, whistles, flutes, cello, and more, and pianist Jason Roach. They make up Cui in their album called Rove. We've got the new one from Molly Tuttle on the way. We've got the wonderful voice of Claire Lynch and the trio I'm With Her. All still to come in this hour of Trail Mix on KPR. Support for Trail Mix on Kansas Public Radio comes from Kansas Tree Care. Local arborists who provide professional tree care in the greater Lawrence area, who can be reached at kansastreecare.com or at 785-843-TREE. Trail Mix is here for you because of listener financial support. If you're not yet one of those supporters, I hope you become one right now, and here's how you can do that.
It's very simple. Just go to kansaspublicradio.org and make a pledge there, or by calling us toll-free at 888-577-5268. Thanks very much, Bob. And I got to say, listening to the Bothy Band this afternoon, I was just struck by the beauty of that marvelous Irish band. And music like that is a very typical thing that you get with Trail Mix each and every Sunday afternoon. It is the fall pledge drive, and it's one of those times of year where, in addition to bringing you beautiful music, news, jazz, exciting programs, and everything that we do here on KPR, we also bring you the crucial reminder that you are crucial to KPR. Everything that we do here is made possible by listener support, as Bob mentioned, whether that means programming from our ever-expanding musical library to bringing in local musicians and ensembles to perform in our live performance studio. All of that is supported by you. Without you, there is no music library, there is no live performance studio, and there is no Trail Mix, and that would be a bleak prospect indeed. It's a great time to pledge as well, because we're very close to meeting a challenge on our board from Dr. Anne Francis of Topeka, and I also understand, Max, that there's another challenge on our board in addition.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Jeff. Max Paley here with KPR, and so happy to be here with David J. Brown and you, Jeff. We do have a second challenge that's on the board, an additional way to have your dollars have a greater impact on Kansas Public Radio, supporting the programming that you're listening to right now, just like Trail Mix, all the programming you enjoy throughout the week. And that's coming from Rachel Lyle of Lawrence. She's matching all pledges up to $800, dollar for dollar right now. So in addition to the challenge we have from Dr. Anne Francis, and thank you, Dr. Francis, for contributing to KPR in this way, Rachel Lyle is also going to match your pledge. It's a double match opportunity right now for this last hour of Trail Mix on Sunday. Maybe you are able to give $10 a month. Maybe $25 a month is something that fits in your budget. KPR and public broadcasting is so great because there is no set fee. It's whatever you can afford. That's what we're asking right now. Get your pledge double matched right now at kansaspublicradio.org, or you can call 888 577-5268.
You can join folks like Thomas Vanderhyde, who contributed, an existing member, and we truly appreciate his gift, or Bruce Dierking, who is a new member. Oh, Bruce, terrific. Thank you from Marysville. That's wonderful. We really are looking for new members. This is an excellent opportunity. You know, if you could contribute $100, then Dr. Ann Francis of Topeka would add $100 to that $100, and then Rachel Lyle would add $100 to that $100, and right. I try not to do math in public, but I think that's you turn your $100 into $300 for Kansas Public Radio, and that is exciting and something that really is terrific. So if you're a new member or an existing member and you want to boost your membership, join the sustainers who are really critical to the station. However you want to do it, please do it. We need your help. It's KansasPublicRadio.org or 888-577-5268.
Now really is the best time to chip in to support Trail Mix. Your pledge will be essentially tripled. It will be matched twice. Rachel Lyle is going to match it. Dr. Ann Francis is going to add in another $100, like David Brown says. And speaking of David Brown, thank you for being here, by the way. And we heard from a Ron Schneider of Lawrence, Kansas, and he said, please say on the air that David Brown rocks. And I agree with that. David, of course, would never say that himself, so I had to jump in there. And if you think David Brown rocks, if you think Bob McWilliams rocks, maybe you think Jeff Watson rocks with his afternoon classical show five days a week.
Maybe Max rocks.
Well, I don't know about that, but we think that you rock. Show us your support right now for Kansas Public Radio. Take advantage of this match, this challenge, matching your funds from Rachel Lyle and also the added $100 from Dr. Ann Francis of Topeka. You can do it online at kansaspublicradio.org.
That's correct. Kansas Public Radio rocks, and so do you. Thanks for tuning in to Trail Mix this afternoon. And remember that it's a great opportunity for your pledge to be matched, and your pledge goes much farther to Kansas Public Radio this afternoon, thanks to Rachel Lyle of Lawrence, as well as Dr. Ann Francis of Topeka. Pledge 10, 20, or even more every month to ensure that this service continues to grow and is here reliably for you each and every day of the year. Let's send you back to music on KPR.
Life's road needs a companion to ride along through the rain and snow. Across the desert canyon, found a friend when you jumped in. Shotgun, a love to last until the journey's end. Like a river running to the ocean blue, like a million roads leading back to you. You're my destination, you're my wheels fall off. Just a road map and an old guitar thrown in the backseat, following a shooting star. You fly me down some back street like a dream when you jumped in. Shotgun, now I don't want this high. Wheels fall off.
That's Molly Tuttle and the song The Highway Knows, which is from her new album this year, So Long, Little Miss Sunshine. And you may have gathered from that that Molly has moved away from her bluegrass band to go into more of a full band Americana sound. And she's done that sort of thing before, very versatile musician. And she's a great guitarist and great singer in any kind of musical setting, as far as I can tell. Molly Tuttle, So Long Little Miss Sunshine, the album, and Molly on tour for this album, coming to Lawrence's Liberty Hall on October the 11th. Molly Tuttle at Liberty Hall on what they call the Highway Knows Tour. In a bit, we're going to hear that wonderful trio of Sarah Jarosz, Sarah Watkins, and Eva O'Donovan. I'm with her, but right now, one of the great voices in bluegrass music, Claire Lynch, who's not a strict bluegrasser, draws upon lots of other musical styles and traditions, and again, just a great, great singer. From her 2009 album, What You Gonna Do, we're going to hear two really fine covers. The first, the Dana Cooper song, Great Day in the Morning, and then Susan Werner's song, Barbed Wire Boys, is sung by Claire Lynch here on KPR's Kraut Mix.
Great day in the morning, I got a lot to be thankful for. Yellow maples, a red roof barn, the sun coming up like a medicine ball. Great day in the morning, ain't it? Turn on your radio, turn up that song, sweetness. Ain't it the one that we both know? Turn it up a little higher, turn it up, that's fine. Great day in the morning, darling, let's kick our heels up high. I wanna kiss you, stop yawning, there ain't one dark cloud in the sky.
Treat this field.
his touch. If you reach too far, if you feel too much, so their deepest hopes were never expressed. And just be like birds' wings in the cage of their chest. All the restless longings, all the secret joys, they never were set free in the barbed wire boys.
Susan Werner's song, Barbed Wire Boys. Susan, a brilliant songwriter, and never more than in that song. And Dana Cooper's joyful song, Great Day in the Morning, opened the set. The 2009 album called What You Gonna Do, and Claire Lynch had a terrific band at that time. Jim Hurst playing guitar and banjo, Jason Thomas mandolin and fiddle, and the wonderful Mark Schatz playing bass with Claire Lynch here on Kansas Public Radio. We've got the Accidentals on the way and the Waylon Jennies, and we've got the wonderful trio, I'm With Her, next. Support for Chromix on KPR comes from Peasley Tech in Lawrence, Kansas. The Peasley Promise offers debt-free career training for local high school students and low-income Douglas County residents. Details and donation information at peasleytech.org/peasleypromise.
Sunlight breaking through the blinds, someone shouts, come on, it's time. Rushing out the door and buckle up. Digging around in the tapes on the passenger side. Push one in, press rewind, the windshield wipers keeping time. Oh, when I was nine, heard you singing about the five and dime. What's that? I asked and my mama said, they were everywhere when I was a kid. I hear the fiddle and Marshall playing long after the show, and your voice runs like the breezes through me, wild and clear and blue. Feet shuffling across the floor, thumbing through the bins to find a friend. I pick one out and I put it on, dancing alone to my favorite song under the flicker of fluorescent lights. Oh, when I was nine, heard you singing about paradise. What's that? I asked and my mama said, that was everywhere when I was a kid. I hear the fiddle and the bar still playing long after the show, and your voice runs like the breezes through me, wild and clear and blue. While the world
cut lines across the sky. Your voices are swirling around me, driving into the West Texas night, breathing in the scent of the sagebrush, tears cutting lines across my face. Now the static is slowly replacing the sounds of my childhood days. We were singing about paradise. What's that? I asked and my mama said that was everywhere when I was a kid. I hear the fiddle and the bow still playing long after the show. And love runs like the peasants through me, wild and clear and blue.
Wild and Clear and Blue, that song, the title song to the new album this year from the trio, I Am With Her. I'm Bob McWilliams. I've got more music today on Trail Mix and the Accidentals and the Waylon Jennies. But right now, it's time to remind you that if you love this music on KPR, and I bet you do, now it's time for you to step up financially supported. Here's how you can become a member of Kansas Public Radio.
Always a very simple proposition. Just make your pledge online safely, securely, and very conveniently at kansaspublicradio.org. You can also call us toll-free and speak with a volunteer at 888-577-5268. It's Jeff Watson here again with David J. Brown and Max Paley here for another appeal. A reminder that you are crucial to everything that we do here on Kansas Public Radio, and your support is needed right now. Trail Mix continues until 4 p.m. and we'll bring you Weekend All Things Considered at that time. But before that happens, we are close, so very close, tantalizingly close, to making an important goal that we have here for Trail Mix this afternoon, just one pledge away from meeting a challenge by Dr. Anne Francis of Topeka, and about $740 overall to raise before 4 p.m. That's how much money that Rachel Lyle of Lawrence is matching pledges dollar for dollar right now. Before 4 p.m. rolls around, this, but it takes your support and your willingness to pledge right now. So if Trail Mix is your jam, it's more important than ever to get your pledge in now to kansaspublicradio.org.
Hi, I'm David Brown, and I'm here to tell you that this, right now, is the last time today that we're going to be pitching for this program. If Trail Mix means something to you, now's the time to pledge. We're running out of time. We'll be off the air in a little bit. And there won't be another pledge drive for Trail Mix in this fall fanfare. So we need you to call. Dr. Anne Francis of Topeka will add $100 to your pledge, and your pledge will be matched dollar for dollar by Rachel Lyle, a friend of mine, who is really been generous. So if you could make a pledge of $740 right now, you would help us meet the goal that we've had for this program today. And if we do not meet goals, programming goes away. If you listen carefully to what's on this station, you will see there are programs that are going away. And one of the many reasons for that is that they cost money. This program costs money. We need your support at kansaspublicradio.org or 888-577-5268 to keep the program on the air. kansaspublicradio.org, 888-577-5268. It's now the time.
Now is the time, and we've heard from so many folks already out there who love Trail Mix. We've heard from Holton, Kansas. We've heard from Marysville and Lawrence. You know, I haven't seen any donations come in from Manhattan or Emporia in a while, and I know that there are Trail Mix listeners out there. If Trail Mix is important to you, if Kansas Public Radio is important to you, be the next caller right now. Help us meet this challenge from Dr. Anne Francis of Topeka, no matter what dollar amount you're able to give, because, of course, when you donate to a public broadcasting station like Kansas Public Radio, there's no set fee. It's whatever you are able to give comfortably within your means in any amount, Dr. Ann Francis is going to add $100 to the pledge. Be the next caller, 888-577-5268, or it's easy to do online, kansaspublicradio.org.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, the time crunch is serious. We've only got very short breaks this time. We're asking for your support because you listen to the program. You rely on this program, and by goodness, we rely on you. So please, kansaspublicradio.org or 888-577-5268.
That's how you make your pledge of support to Kansas Public Radio this afternoon. That's how you make your voice heard. If you've got opinions about the recent move to eliminate federal funding for public media nationwide, this is a way to make your voice heard on that matter. Pledge at kansaspublicradio.org or toll free at 888-577-5268. So many of the things in our lives that are important also require our attention. And if Trail Mix is important to you, we have just a little while to go to make your voice heard in support of this program. There's a bit more Trail Mix until 4 p.m., and we'll have volunteers standing by to take your call and your pledge of support. Kansas Public Radio is here for you each and every day of the year, and we're asking you now to take your step in being here for Kansas Public Radio. We thank each and every one of you from the bottom of our hearts for pledging today. Thanks so much, and we'll enjoy more Trail Mix on KPR.
I'm standing on the tarmac with a suitcase and a backpack, getting cold feet as I'm waiting in line. Here to catch a second wind and try and change my life again, but the only thing that's changing is my mind. What I need to know about me, what I'm hoping I can figure out someday, is did the plane take off without me, or did I wait to watch that bird fly away? I'm standing on the tarmac wondering how to get a love back when the truest form of love is letting go. Maybe this is how you do it, you let fate be you to it, till it leaves you in the taillights afterglow. What I need to know about me, what I'm hoping I can figure out someday, is did the plane take off without me, or did I wait to watch that bird fly away? Sometimes I think I'm overthinking. I'm a coward when it's time to make the call. Wanting so much to do the right thing that I don't do.
The Accidentals from their album this year, Time Out Number 3, here on KPR, their song Fly Away, which they wrote together with Georgia Middleman and Gary Burr, with the Waylon Jennies next. Support for Trail Mix on Kansas Public Radio comes from Kansas Tree Care. Local arborists provide professional tree care in the greater Lawrence area, who can be reached at kansastreecare.com or at 785-843-TREE.
Spent it in good company. the day I've had. I'm sorry for my going away and all the sweethearts the day I've had would wish me one more day to stay. But since it falls unto my lot that I should rise and you should not, I'll gently rise and I'll softly call good night and joy be with you all. Good night and joy be.
The voices of Ruth Moody, Cara Left, Nikki Mehta, the Waylon Jennies, going back to their 2004 album, 40 Days, a song by Ruth Moody, Heaven When We're Home, and then just an exquisite version of the traditional song, The Parting Glass, and that always gives me goosebumps when I hear the Waylon Jennies singing that, and it did today as well. For you here on Kansas Public Radio's Trail Mix, I'm Bob McWilliams, and I want to thank you so very much for all the support you've given to KPR during our fall fun drive, and especially today during Trail Mix. But there's still time to get that support in by calling 1-888-577-5268 or making your pledge online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Stardate September 28th. The Andromeda Galaxy, M31, is encircled by dozens of satellites, smaller galaxies in orbit around it. One of the larger satellites is something of an oddball. Of the three dozen brightest, it's the only one that lines up on the far side of Andromeda, as seen from our home galaxy, the Milky Way. M31 is the closest giant galaxy to the Milky Way, just 2.5 million light-years away. Messier 110 is a couple of 100,000 light-years farther. It's a few thousand light-years in diameter and contains about 10 billion stars, a tiny fraction the size of Andromeda. Astronomers have spent years watching M31's entourage with Hubble Space Telescope. They recently reported that 36 of the 37 brightest members line up on the side of M31 that faces the Milky Way. And that's hard to explain. The study said there's only a tiny chance that the alignment is a coincidence. There must be a reason for it. But no one knows what that reason might be. It's not a result of the Milky Way's gravitational pull. It's not strong enough. So there's no obvious explanation for why M110 is an oddball, lurking on the far side of M31. M31 is low in the northeast at nightfall. Under dark skies, it looks like a hazy slash of light about as wide as the moon. Through a small telescope, M110 looks like a bright star close by. You can find out how to subscribe to our daily program at stardate.org. For the McDonald Observatory, I'm Billy Henry.
And for Kansas Public Radio, I'm Bob McWilliams. Support for Stardate on KPR comes from Blue Collar Press. Blue Collar Press has been helping businesses, musicians, and artists, big and small, turn ideas into promotional merchandise for 20 years. For more information, visit bluecollarpress.com.
Next time on KPR Presents, KPR's own Matthew Algio and the story of New York City's secret subway.
Alfred envisioned a country crisscrossed by pneumatic tube transportation. He saw pneumatic tubes shooting across the country, over the mountains, through the mountains, over the rivers, under the rivers. I think he really saw it as the future of transportation.
That's on KPR Presents, 6 o'clock Sunday evening on Kansas Public Radio.
You know that Morning Edition keeps you up to date on the news, but did you know it might help you find a new hobby?
People go beachcombing for lots of different things. Shells, rocks, driftwood. We're after sea glass.
We also bring you stories that make you smile.
It's really cool to be in an environment where there's only girls in jazz.
Join us weekday mornings for the news and a little something unexpected on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition here, weekday mornings, 5 to 9 on KPR. We're here, and we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Oldsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org. Tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. Support for Trail Mix on KPR comes from the Kaw Valley Farm Tour, an opportunity to explore 33 farms and 6 heritage sites throughout the Kaw River Valley. Activities for the whole family, October 4th and 5th. Details at kawvalleyfarmtour.com. And Mammoth presented singer-songwriter Noah Reed, best known for playing Patrick from Schitt's Creek on Saturday, October the 4th at Liberty Hall. Tickets available through Ticketmaster.com. And Bob McWilliams here with All Things Considered Next. Just want to thank you again for not only listening as you do so many Sundays, but for so many of you contributing financially to help support Trail Mix and Kansas Public Radio. So a great big thank you from me, Bob McWilliams.
Don't use the military against its citizens unless it's none of which are manifesting in our country right now.
Oregon braces for the possibility of President Trump deploying military troops. For Sunday, September 28th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. Also this week,
Mr. President, as you meet Prime Minister Netanyahu, please make the hostages your top priority.
As President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu meet at the White House to talk about a new plan for Gaza, we hear reflections from Israel. We also head to the skies. An historic flight school revamps its aeronautical program.
We haven't had any flying activity since the airmen. So I was like, why not be a part of something new here at Tuskegee?
And it's officially fall. We share our favorite cozy comfort movies. But first, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. In Michigan, authorities are searching for additional victims in a burned church where a gunman opened fire, killing at least 2 people and injuring more than a half dozen worshipers this morning, about 60 miles north of Detroit. The gunman was also killed. Michigan Public's Steve Carmody has more.
The Sunday worship service at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Grand Blanc, Michigan was underway when an unidentified 40-year-old man allegedly drove his vehicle through the front doors of the church. Authorities say he then started shooting, and he may also have started a fire in the church. Grand Blanc Police Chief William Rennie says the attack ended when 2 law enforcement officers arrived at the church.
They met the suspect and they engaged in gunfire with that particular individual, neutralizing that suspect.
Authorities are not releasing a motive for the attack on the church or whether the suspect was known to local law enforcement. For NPR News, I'm Steve Carmody in Flint, Michigan.
Mayor Eric Adams says he's dropping out of the New York City mayor's race, shaking up a race that's been dominated by newcomer Zohran Mamdani. NPR's Brian Mann has more.
In a video posted on social media, Adams said he's dropping out after facing what he described as unfair investigations that made it difficult for him to raise money and campaign.
Although this is the end of my reelection campaign, it is not the end of my public service.
Last year, the U.S. Justice Department charged Adams with bribery and campaign finance offenses, later dropped by the DOJ under President Trump. With Adams out, Zohran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist who's led in the polls, faces a tighter contest against former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Cuomo stepped down as governor in 2021 following a sexual misconduct scandal. In this race, Cuomo has sought to portray Mamdani as too far to the left. Republican Curtis Sliwa rounds out the 3-way race. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is preparing to meet President Trump at the White House tomorrow. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more.
President Trump said on social media, "We have a real chance for greatness in the Middle East. All are on board for something special." Vice President J.D. Vance said the U.S. was negotiating with Arab and Israeli leaders over the ceasefire plan. A person briefed on the plan, not authorized to speak publicly, told NPR Trump is proposing that Hamas release all hostages at the start of a Gaza ceasefire and that a multinational Arab and Muslim peacekeeping force gradually replace Israeli troops in Gaza. A Hamas official told NPR Hamas was not given an official offer, but was being briefed by mediators on the details. Hamas says it's lost contact with two Israeli hostages in Gaza City due to Israeli bombardment. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Beef prices are at an all-time high. The Department of Agriculture says it will release a plan to rebuild the cattle industry. Gavin McGough from member station KXCV has more.
Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins discussed the forthcoming plan in Kansas City, leading to speculation amongst cattle farmers. High beef prices present farmers with a tough choice. Hold back heifers and grow their herd, or hope that consumers continue to pay top dollar. Deb Thummel raises Black Angus on her family farm in northwest Missouri. She says despite the uncertainty, she doesn't think
any beef producers really want the government to throw money at these high prices and lack of cattle.
The USDA says it will release its plan in October. For NPR News, I'm Gavin McGough.
At the weekend box office, Warner Brothers, one battle after another, took the top spot, debuting with $22 million in ticket sales. Paul Thomas Anderson's widely acclaimed American epic of rebellion and resistance cost a reported $130 million to produce. The film, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Teyana Taylor, and Sean Penn, has been hailed as a film brimming with many of the political conflicts of today. In second place, Gabby's Dollhouse, the movie, the Universal Pictures release, produced by DreamWorks Animation, took in $13 million. For the G-rated film based on the long-running series, it cost $32 million to produce. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Legacy Box, dedicated to helping customers turn boxes with family videos and photos into memories that can be shared with generations to come. More at legacybox.com. This is NPR.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. It's 88 and fair. Wind is from the west at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 60s. Then tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid 80s. Wind will be from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the low 60s. Wind will be from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. It's 88 and fair. From KPR's 24-hour weather center, I'm Maria Lopez.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. President Trump and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will meet face-to-face tomorrow. They're expected to talk about Gaza, where Israel started a new ground offensive this month, and where a UN commission recently declared Netanyahu and other Israeli officials were responsible for genocide against Palestinians there. Meanwhile, the U.S. says it's going to present Israel, Palestinian leaders, and Arab countries a plan soon to end the war and rebuild Gaza. With us to explain just what is going on is NPR's Emily Fang, who is in Tel Aviv. Hey, Emily.
Hello there.
So what do we know about this plan that the U.S. says it is working on?
So a person familiar with the plans, but who is not authorized to speak publicly about it, tells NPR that the proposal is to end the war, return all remaining hostages to Israel within 48 hours, and then for the reconstruction of Gaza to be supervised at first by a coalition of international partners. And one name that's been floated around to temporarily lead that international mechanism is Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister. And his institute confirmed with us that he has been working on a plan for some kind of international transitional body to lead Gaza. Trump has already presented this plan to several Arab leaders who were in New York last week for the United Nations General Assembly. And we know that the U.S. is now really pushing Israel to end the war. They've asked Israel to give the U.S. a hard deadline for when it's going to stop its war in Gaza, which is something that Netanyahu has been very vague about publicly. U.S. Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff told reporters that there might be a breakthrough on the plan in the coming days, but We reached out to Hamas negotiators who say they have not yet received any kind of written proposal of this plan. And so the question now is there enough pressure on the U.S. and Hamas, on Israel, to overcome fundamental disagreements which have sunk previous ceasefire proposals?
All right, you mentioned fundamental disagreements. What are those?
Well, first, I have to mention that earlier this month, Israel launched airstrikes on Qatar, another country where Israel tried but failed to kill negotiators for Hamas. So, not to put it too lightly, there is very little trust between everyone. Then there's the fact that right-wing politicians who Netanyahu really needs to maintain his political coalition in Israel, these politicians have been repeatedly calling to displace the 2 million or so Palestinians who live in Gaza and then move them to another country, and they want to even annex the West Bank, which is another Palestinian territory. This U.S. plan that we're talking about wants Palestinians to stay in Gaza. But Trump's remarks on that front have been very inconsistent. He's previously talked about, for example, building a resort in Gaza. And then finally, there's this issue of Palestinian sovereignty. In this particular U.S. plan and another plan, which was endorsed by the United Nations earlier this month, it would be the Palestinian Authority, which currently governs parts of the West Bank, that would also govern Gaza at some point. But Israel's Netanyahu has made it clear he will not accept the PA. Here he is speaking to the UN this past week.
Because you see, the Palestinian Authority is corrupt to the core. They haven't held elections in 20 years. They use the same textbooks as Hamas, exactly the same textbooks.
During that speech, by the way, dozens of diplomats staged a walkout of Netanyahu. And again, there's pressure from the U.S. for Israel to do something. And even in Israel itself, the idea of continuing its war is unpopular.
Why is that?
People are tired of war. Next week is the 2-year anniversary of October 7th. And most importantly, Israelis fear the hostages that are kept there are endangered by its own war. Here's Doron Steinberger speaking at this huge weekly rally for the hostages, which I went to last night. Steinberger was held hostage herself in Gaza, and in her speech last night, she bemoaned how she felt the Israeli government had abandoned them by expanding the war, not ending it. And then she switched from Hebrew to English, and notably to me, she addressed President Trump, not Netanyahu.
Mr. President, as you meet Prime Minister Netanyahu, please make the hostages your top priority.
The latest survey of Israelis done just a few days ago shows just over half of people want an end to the war so they can get back the hostages.
That's NPR's Emily Fang in Tel Aviv. Thanks, Emily.
Thanks, Andrew.
In Mexico, September is traditionally the season for chile en nogada. That's a stuffed poblano pepper drowned in a walnut sauce. But there is one big problem. One of the key ingredients, a candied barrel cactus called biznaga, used in the chile and other holiday staples, is illegal to use because it's going extinct in the wild. NPR's Ada Peralta reports.
Here at La Merced, a huge market in the middle of Mexico City, acitron is sold in almost every stall. They're little yellow blocks that look like lemon bars. It's a barrel cactus that is chopped up and then seeped in vats of sugar until it's crystallized. Edith Hernandez Torres, who runs a shop here, says the acitron doesn't taste like the candied lemon or sweet potato or the pineapple she sells. It has a chewy texture, she says, like something roasted. She knows acitron is illegal, but her clients demand it. I ask her, don't you feel a little bad that you're selling something that's going extinct? She shrugs. Our whole planet is going extinct, she says, and that does make me feel bad. As she speaks, Maria Julia Gutierrez gently picks up a bar. Her husband and this nation were born on the same day, September 16th. So every year she buys the pears, the peaches, the pink pine nuts, and the acitron to make the perfect stuffed chile.
Las tradiciones es como la pimienta y la sal de la vida, como ese extra que no es cotidiano.
Traditions are the salt and pepper of life, she says. They are that extra something that make life extraordinary. When she says this, her eyes tear up. She never had chiles en nogada growing up because the ingredients were too expensive. She studied, she became a nurse. When you grow up and make your own money, you save for nice things, she says. And so for Independence Day, she wants to treat her family to something special.
and the chiles en nogada, she says, have to be made with acitrón. The biznaga has played an important role in Mexico, even before the Spanish introduced the sugar that made it so sweet. I meet Salvador Arias at the National Autonomous University of Mexico's Botanical Garden. He's the biologist who runs this place.
En México tenemos más de 150 especies de biznaga.
In Mexico, there are more than 150 species of barrow cacti. Most of them are going extinct. Arias walks me over to a collection of golden barrow cacti.
Las cinco biznagas grandes que hoy tenemos acá, uno, dos, tres.
The five big cacti in front of us, he says, were rescued by helicopter. Mexico built a hydroelectric dam where these golden barrow cacti live, and in an instant, their environment was destroyed, and this species was almost wiped out. Some of the cacti are 40 years old and they reach to your thighs. Others are 8 years old, and they're tiny, just the size of your fist.
Vengan, miren.
He moves us toward a darker-looking barrow cacti, the one that acitrón is made from.
No crecen como el pasto.
These cacti don't grow like grass.
Porque su metabolismo es particularmente lento.
Because their metabolism is especially slow.
Tan lento que pueden crecer milímetros por año.
It's so slow, they might grow millimeters each year. So farming is unprofitable and impractical.
Yo soy optimista.
But I'm an optimist, he says.
Creo que las cactáceas han sido capaces de evolucionar en ambientes contrastantes.
I believe that cacti have evolved in the past to thrive in contrasting environments. He thinks they can do it again. He walks toward his collection of nopales, the cactus that adorns the Mexican flag, the cactus that is an everyday staple in Mexican kitchens. This species is thriving for one evolutionary reason.
Los nopales crecen de forma modular.
The nopal is modular. That means that unlike the biznaga, humans can cut off and eat the newest shoots without killing the whole plant. At the Restaurant Azul, I sit with Chef Ricardo Muñoz Zurita. His chile en nogada is legendary. It's so important that for this season, the tablecloths go black and the silverware goes gold.
Es un ritual. Es un ritual.
It's a yearly ritual, he says. The waiters bring out a tray of poblano peppers topped with a green, white, and red bow. And after they place one on your plate, they douse it with a creamy walnut sauce, as silky as melted white chocolate. Muñoz says this plate is the soul of Mexico.
Sabe a patria, sabe a independencia, sabe a México.
The chiles taste like the motherland, he says, like independence, like Mexico itself. Muñoz serves the recipe from 1821. It's what the independence hero Agustín de Iturbide was served right after signing a treaty that consummated Mexico's independence. Muñoz is a traditionalist, but he doesn't use biznaga. Instead, he uses candied chilacayota, which is a type of squash.
Realmente no es muy diferente el acabado final.
In a blind taste test, he found the finished plate tasted just the same. But Mexicans, says Muñoz, are diehards about tradition.
Si tú eso lo aprendiste a hacer de tu abuelita o de tu mamá y tu
abuelita. If you learn to make it from your grandma or mom, and they used acitrón, he says, I understand why they would want to keep using it. But he feels a responsibility not to, because he wants barrow cactuses to survive in the wild.
Creo que los seres humanos tenemos un poder muy importante de adaptación.
We humans have the great power of adaptation, and in this case, he says, we'd be wise to use it. Peter Palta, NPR News, Mexico City.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio.
available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Sunday afternoon. Support for All Things Considered comes from the Lawrence Public Library, offering downloadable e-books, audiobooks, streaming movies, and more, all available with a library card. Card information at lplks.org. And the Kaw Valley Farm Tour, an opportunity to explore 33 farms and 6 heritage sites throughout the Kaw River Valley. Activities for the whole family, October 4th and 5th. Details at kawvalleyfarmtour.com. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, mostly clear skies, a low of 61 degrees. For tomorrow, sunny with a high of 83. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. In Michigan, police say at least 2 people are dead, several others injured, after a man drove a vehicle through the front doors of a church this morning, got out, and started shooting using an assault rifle. They believe he then started a fire that burned much of the building. The gunman is dead. There's no word on a motive. President Trump meets Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House tomorrow. Netanyahu is under international pressure to end Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza. And nearly 60 million pounds of corn dogs and other sausages on a stick products have been recalled because pieces of wood may be in the batter. The recall covers some State Fair corn dogs on a stick and Jimmy Dean pancakes and sausages on a stick, both from Hillshire Brands. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates age of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. From Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at VisitSPC.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. President Trump says he's ordered troops to Portland, Oregon. In a post on Truth Social, Trump called the city war-ravaged and claimed that federal troops will help protect ICE facilities from Antifa and what he called domestic terrorists. In response, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek said yesterday that there is no national security threat in Portland, and she called the planned mobilization an abuse of power. For more on the response from Oregon to the White House's plan, we're joined now by Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield. Hi, welcome to All Things Considered.
How are you doing?
I imagine you're busier than I am. So what have you heard directly from the administration about what to expect?
So we have been trying to engage with the Trump administration. A lot of credit to our governor, who has been speaking with the Trump administration to let them know what the reality is on the ground, and that we live in a country where you don't mobilize the United States military against its own citizens, except under extreme conditions like rebellion and insurrection. And those facts just aren't manifesting themselves here on the ground. We all care about public safety, incredibly important. But we have a local police, the Oregon State Police, and a district attorney that is upholding our laws.
Wait, so what do you actually know from the administration? Are troops being sent? Do you know, like, how many? Is it clear?
Well, from the very early on, this is something we prepared for from day one. The president has been talking about this, and he has sent a letter to the state effectively asking the governor to mobilize the National Guard voluntarily. And the governor has said no. The president made a threat in the letter that if you don't do it, I'm going to do it for you. Now, legally, you have to meet certain prerequisites to be able to do that. And that's what the president is, you know, talking about trying to do. And should he actually mobilize the U.S. military to come into Portland, we'll be ready to file a lawsuit to tell the courts that he has not met those prerequisites.
If you kind of are unsure as to what to expect from the president at this point, how do you prepare? Like, what legal avenues are you using if you don't know what's coming?
as a entity that's here to protect Oregonians, we have to be ready in the event of all circumstances. So last week, I told our folks at Oregon Department of Justice that I want to be ready should the president act. I want to be in a court within 12 hours so that we can be ready and be responsive to anything that the federal government brings. When they overstep, we're going to hold them accountable in court. And so that has been our approach moving forward. The first steps were taken. Now we're waiting to hear back from the federal government. And once we get responses, then we'll act accordingly.
The Trump administration has deployed federal troops in D.C., in Los Angeles, and he's threatened to do so in other U.S. cities. Have you spoken to any leaders in any of those other cities in anticipation? Have you just compared notes?
So we've been regularly meeting, collaborating in terms of being ready and understanding how the Trump administration is pursuing some of their avenues. And for folks just to remember, in those lawsuits that were filed in Washington, D.C. and in Southern California, they were successful. You have had judges that have told the Trump administration you've stepped too far, right? Things that we all kind of, you know, take for granted, but also just know you don't use the military against its citizens unless it's extreme conditions. None of which are manifesting in our country right now.
What have you been telling Portland residents?
So you have a unified message from all of our leaders across the state in every community, which is we have an organized plan. You need to follow our laws. We want you to exercise free speech when things are, you know, go a direction that you don't feel comfortable with, right? The way that Trump is implementing a very unpopular ICE agenda, breaking promises, going against people who are just trying to, you know, take their kids to school. You should voice your opinions about that. You should protest, but do it peacefully, do it lawfully. And when you don't, we'll hold you accountable. And we're doing that here in Oregon. However, if the Trump administration pushes beyond their legal authority and mobilizes the U.S. military, we will be there. We will be in court to say, no, you have to follow our Constitution. You have to follow our laws. And it doesn't matter whether you're protesting or whether you're the president of the United States abusing your executive powers.
That's Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield speaking with us about President Trump's announced deployment of troops to Portland. Attorney General, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Even though it is fall, it's hot and muggy and gross at a time when all I want to do is wear a big sweater, sip on a cup of tea, and be in full-on cozy mode. Instead, let's manifest those vibes through movies. On this week's Movie Conversation segment, we're going to talk about our favorite comfort watches, the films that feel like a warm blanket, with All Things Considered producer Mallory Yu. Hey, Mallory.
Hey, Andrew.
And Stephen Thompson, host of Pop Culture Happy Hour. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Andrew.
All right, so I know both of you have watched a ton of movies.
Mm-hmm.
What does it take for one to become a comfort watch, the kind that you turn to when you want to feel better? Stephen, why don't you start?
Well, you know, I think that comfort watching kind of begins with a sense of familiarity, right? Like, it helps to have seen the movie before. It helps that the movie has made you feel good. It helps that the movie has maybe a sense of optimism, a sense that things will work out in the end. And I think that for those who live with family or partners or loved ones, I think a sense of shared experience can be a big part of this. There are movies that I watch with my partner or with my kids that I might never think to watch by myself. So, you know, I think if you're around the right people in the right setting, anything can be a comfort movie.
I agree with that, Stephen. Like, that sense of familiarity is really, really important. For me, a comfort watch is kind of subjective. It sort of depends on the context and my mood. It basically is one that I can count on to bring about a certain feeling or emotion that I like or need to feel, whether that emotion is positive or negative sometimes. You know, sometimes I want a cozy blanket tea kind of movie like the Keira Knightley Pride and Prejudice, where it's familiar,
it's
soft.
I just watched that for the first time.
Yeah, it's like, it's soft and quiet and really pretty to look at. There are no surprises. But other times, when I'm feeling especially down, sometimes I need a movie to meet me at that level, like Annihilation, which became kind of comfort movie for me.
That's a wild comfort movie.
I mean, I was in the middle of a depressive slump, so yeah. It sort of met me at the level that I needed it to.
Steven, let's name some names. What movies were you, are you thinking of loading up this season?
Well, one that I come back to again and again, you know, it's not necessarily set in autumn. There aren't a lot of crunching leaves. But one movie that we come back to again and again is Arrival from 2016.
There are days that define your story beyond your life. Like the day they arrived.
Which is about an alien invasion, but it's not an action movie. It's about language. It's about communication as a puzzle that can be solved with cooperation. And it's also about, as kind of Mallory was alluding to, it has an undercurrent of sadness to it. It's about the importance of putting pain and grief into perspective. And it has this, it gives you this very cleansing cry. And the music by Johan Johansson and Max Richter is just incredible. So like that's one that my partner and I are about to rewatch for the umpteenth time once we're kind of snuggling under blankets instead of sweating ourselves.
I know my AC is still on. Sorry to keep harping on this, but this is insane.
No, anyway. I feel you, Andrew. I'm waiting for the weather to get cold. For me, When Harry Met Sally is one that I always want to watch when the weather turns colder.
You know, the first time we met, I really didn't like you that much.
I didn't like you.
Yeah, you did. You were just so uptight then. You're much softer now.
You know, I hate that kind of remark. It sounds like a compliment, but really it's an insult.
Obviously, okay, the movie poster and the DVD cover is that sort of iconic scene of them in Central Park in fall. They are surrounded by red and orange leaves, and you kind of get the feeling that everything is cold around them. I grew up in California, so I very much romanticize that image of East Coast fall, and When Harry Met Sally has always kind of captured that feeling for me.
We talked about that movie last week, and I was screaming at the radio because it's a perfect fall movie because I get a lot of dudes getting dressed on my Instagram content, and like Billy Crystal's roll neck sweater shows up a lot. I get that a lot, and it's like it looks like a cozy sweater. We can go down a whole tangent of they don't make sweaters like they used to.
They really don't.
The thing is, that movie, I hate that movie. I so fundamentally disagree with its central premise, and that like my wife really likes it. We throw it on, and then it's like, damn, now we got to get into an argument. This sucks.
That's so crazy. Funny. So it's the opposite of a comfort movie.
But while we're talking about great depictions of sweaters in movies, let's talk about Knives Out.
Good sweater movie.
So somebody suspects foul play and goes through this hatchet dance of hiring me, of staying anonymous. It makes no damn sense. Compels me, though.
You know, Chris Evans' sweater in Knives Out is iconic. And, you know, when we talk about cozy movies, our thoughts often go to cozy mysteries. And I think those Knives Out movies, the first Knives Out, Glass Onion, there's another one coming later this fall. Those are great fall movies.
I mostly, in my day job, right, I mostly cover books. And I get all these publicists, you know, sending me pitches about, like, a cozy mystery. This is mystery that is automatically closed. And it's like, what is the link between somebody being murdered and feeling comfortable?
I mean, I think there's like some predictability to it, right? It's kind of why we like the shows that solve a murder of the week, because you sort of can expect that there will be some kind of justice that happens at the end, that murder will be solved, that you will find the perpetrators. And so when you enter one of these mysteries, you can kind of enjoy the ride knowing that it'll conclude in a way that you like.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I think there's a sense of a familiar formula that goes in. And, you know, the Knives Out movies are very inspired by kind of Agatha Christie and kind of these classic mysteries where it's like there's a room full of people and one of them is the killer. There's something very contained about that formula where you know at the end of the movie that puzzle is going to get solved. And I think that's one reason that people go back not only to cozy mysteries, but to kind of episodic television, you know, that is giving you kind of a set result at the end of the episode where you know there's going to be resolution. I think that's part of the coziness more than the murder.
Yeah. All right. We're at the end of September. October is coming, which means we are beginning to enter spooky season. I already, you know, bought all my Costco candy ahead of time. while we're thinking about Halloween, what are you guys thinking for about Halloween watches?
Hocus Pocus. Hocus Pocus is as cozy as a Halloween movie gets.
Absolutely. Or like Halloween Town, there's any number of them. I know Stephen said that a lot of the cozy movies that he enjoys don't include a lot of murder and blood and violence, but one that I like to put on that is fun is Chopping Mall.
What is it?
Chopping Mall. It is an 80s B-horror movie about a shopping mall that has a robot security system that malfunctions and turns deadly, which is unfortunate for the group of teens who snuck into the mall for some after-hours teenage shenanigans.
We've got to help her!
Thank you, and have a nice day.
It's just a classic of the B-horror slasher genre. It's got great hair, amazing line reads, and a killer, soundtrack. Uh-huh. It just delights me every single time I watch it, and I think it's appropriate for the spooky season.
Is it one
season.
Of those movies that knows it's hokey, or is it taking itself very seriously?
No. It is not taking itself seriously.
I guess it's called Chopping Mall.
At all. So. Yeah. Okay. Also, Chopping Mall is such a great title for a movie.
Yeah. Steve, you know, what about with the folks with kids? What are you loading up for the whole family? I guess not Chopping Mall, if not Chopping Mall. Yeah.
Well, you know, talking about like cozy fall movies for kids, you know, we come back to animation. You know, Miyazaki movies often have, you know, an autumnal quality to them. You know, Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, you know, was kind of seasonally appropriate, but also there's a playfulness to it. There's a vibrance to what's on the screen.
What's this? What's this? There's color everywhere. What's this? There's white things in the air. What's this?
So I think that comes in handy. You know, anything you go back to and watch again and again and as a family is going to work in that setting. But, you know, when you're talking about thematically fall and family-friendly, a movie like Coco.
Día de los Muertos is the one night of the year our ancestors can come visit us.
We've put their photos on the ofrenda
so their spirits can cross over.
That fits into themes around, you know, the Day of the Dead. It's a Halloween-friendly movie, but it's also sentimental. It's also emotional. It's also very, very comforting.
Yeah. All right, we've been talking to NPR Stephen Thompson and Mallory Yu. Thank you all for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
You are cozily listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Trump administration has terminated another long-running fact-finding program, the Household Food Security Report. The annual survey had been gathering data for 3 decades across 7 administrations. Now, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or USDA, which manages the report, says that the studies, quote, do nothing more than fearmonger. NPR's Jordan Marie Smith has more.
For decades, the National Hunger Report has helped guide advocates, food banks, and policymakers in the fight against hunger in the United States. The 2023 Household Food Security Report found more than 47 million people live in food insecure households. That means residents were uncertain if they could get consistent access to food. Among those counted were nearly 14 million children.
Without that data, we are flying blind.
Crystal Fitzsimons is the president of the Food Research and Action Center, or FRAC. Food insecurity is complicated. Variables like food deserts, the cost of living, and diet quality are frequently changing. Fitzsimons says those who study hunger in America will end up lost without the objective statistics collected in the USDA report.
The National Food Insecurity Survey is a critical, reliable data source that shows how many families in America struggle to put food on the table.
In its announcement, the USDA called the survey redundant and costly. We reached out to the USDA to better understand the decision and to ask about staff impact. A spokesperson responded by saying that, quote, an unauthorized disclosure of non-public information shows questionable judgment, and any employee willing to break that public trust undermines the integrity of the agency. Amy Barros, the president and CEO of the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina, said they use the data year over year to identify changing needs.
We rely on this data to help us target our resources where they're needed most. You know, where do we need to invest more food resources? Where do we need to stand up mobile markets and help identify food deserts?
For the areas Barros and her food bank serve, the numbers show worsening conditions over the past 2 decades. And in the area around the nation's capital, hunger persists too.
It's one of the hardest things I've had to deal with in the last couple of years.
Initial Miller Galloway is a 51-year-old black woman living with four disabled family members in Silver Spring, Maryland. She gets a monthly food assistance box from the local food bank. Food insecurity isn't just about hunger, Miller Galloway says.
To me, it creates anxiety. Just it makes you feel worthless.
Miller Galloway works closely with the Capital Area Food Bank. They rely on the USDA data, along with their own annual hunger report, which compiles county-level numbers across Virginia, Maryland, and all of Washington, D.C. But they're one of the few food banks in the country able to conduct that kind of research, according to the organization's president, Radha Muthaya.
It allows us to plan by understanding the number of people who are food insecure, their demographics, where they live.
Now, there is enough food in America for everyone, but the reports track vulnerable people living paycheck to paycheck who often have to choose between their medicine or their next meal. And without the Household Hunger Survey, Muthaya, Fitzsimons, and Barros say it'll be harder to identify and reach people like Initial Miller Galloway when they need it most.
I didn't eat today. I'm probably going to eat tonight. I'm hopeful that I will, but at the same time, I have prescriptions that I have to pay for.
Jordan Marie Smith, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
President Trump is directing his administration to target his political enemies, such as former FBI Director James Comey.
My family and I have known for years that there are costs to standing up to Donald Trump. But we couldn't imagine ourselves living any other way.
How are other of Trump's perceived foes preparing themselves for possible retribution? That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Sunday afternoon. Once again this year, KPR's Live Day Broadcasts presents our own Destiny Ann Vermeagen in a free concert at the Lawrence Public Library on Friday night, October 24th. The admission's free, but seating, so please RSVP now at that website, kansaspublicradio.org. And we hope you can join us for a night of spooky tunes, tales, and bad jokes for Halloween on Friday night, October 24th at 7, presented by Kansas Public Radio. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, mostly clear skies, a low of 61 degrees. Sunny for tomorrow with a high of 83, Monday night's low 61, and a high of 82 on Tuesday. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. Top congressional leaders are heading to the White House tomorrow for a meeting with President Trump, less than 48 hours before the government could shut down if they can't reach a deal. Who can stop it? Well, depends on who you ask. Today on NBC's Meet the Press, Senate Majority Leader John Thune had this to say.
Totally up to the Democrats. This is, the ball is in their court.
And here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
It depends on the Republicans.
So, no surprise, hearing a lot of the blame game. But what's actually at stake here? Joining us now to talk through this is NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt. Hey, Barbara.
Hey, Andrew.
All right, Barbara, let's back up a bit. The government funding deadline is end of day Tuesday. Remind us how we got to this impasse between the parties on the Hill.
Yeah, so Republicans have been trying to advance a temporary funding bill, a continuing resolution, to keep federal spending levels flat. We've increasingly seen this a lot on the Hill to avoid shutdowns, and it does always feel like it's at the 11th hour. Mm-hmm. House Republicans passed this bill. It would fund the government until November 21st, but it failed in the Senate. And the Senate now wants to bring it up again tomorrow evening to try to pass it. But Republicans won't be able to do it alone. It needs 60 votes to pass. They only have 53 seats, so they need support from Democrats.
Which is why there's this late-breaking meeting at the White House tomorrow, right, to talk through this. And I take it a meeting like this is something Democrats have been clamoring for, yeah?
Yeah, you're right. House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer were supposed to meet with the president at the White House this past week. But President Trump canceled that meeting rather abruptly, saying basically he didn't see the point in meeting with Democrats when they're demanding, in his view, unreasonable things.
Well, what are the Democrats asking for?
Democrats want to secure funding to extend these boosted up Affordable Care Act subsidies that expire at the end of the year, along with reversing some cuts to Medicaid and other health programs that the GOP passed over the summer in this big tax and spending bill. And the Republican position on this has been fund the government first, and then we can negotiate on extending those credits. Here's Senate Majority Leader John Thune on NBC's Meet the Press.
That doesn't happen until the end of the year. We can have that conversation, but before we do, release the hostage. Set the American people free, keep the government open, and then let's have a conversation about those premium tax credits. I'm certainly open to that.
But congressional Democrats have repeatedly said that they want something in writing on this specific aspect in legislation, not just a handshake agreement that it will be addressed later. And I should say that canceled meeting was slated to be just with President Trump and top Democrats. The meeting on the books tomorrow is with those two top Democrats and their Republican counterparts as well.
Hmm. What would a shutdown mean for the American people?
Critical services would continue. Americans would keep getting Social Security payments, payments from Medicare, Medicaid, although there could be delays in processing new applications for those programs. Basically, anything deemed non-essential will be put on hold. People could experience delays in some services like getting certain benefits. National parks could temporarily close. In the past, there have been some environmental inspections that have been delayed during shutdowns. And hundreds of thousands of federal workers could be furloughed without pay until this funding issue is resolved. But also, I should say, in a move that kind of seemingly raised the stakes, the White House's budget arm instructed federal agencies last week to draw up lists of workers to fire permanently if there was a shutdown. That's different than the traditional temporarily furloughing people.
Huh. How did Democrats respond?
Congressional Democrats called it an intimidation tactic, but they also pointed out that the Trump administration has already laid off huge swaths of the federal workforce this year. And Democrats have been saying that it's this meeting with President Trump himself that's coming tomorrow that's going to be crucial for whatever comes next.
That's NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt. Barbara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
On September 29th, 1 year ago, a fire broke out at a biolab facility in Conyers, Georgia. That's a suburb of Atlanta. The fire blanketed the town in toxic smoke, something the people there are still grappling with. Georgia Public Broadcasting's investigative podcast, Manufacturing Danger, The Biolab Story, looks at the incident and its aftermath, and it raises questions about safety standards across the country. GPB's Pamela Kirkland hosts the podcast and joins us now. Hi, Pamela.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So Biolab was a major producer of cleaning products, right, for pools and spas. The fire last year produced a plume of chemical smoke that caused thousands to evacuate and even more to shelter in place. So can you just remind us of what unfolded at Biolab that morning?
Yeah, exactly. So we've been talking about another anniversary, which plays into this. That weekend, the state of Georgia was bracing for impact from Hurricane Helene. Oh. The metro Atlanta area was largely spared, but on Sunday morning, emergency alerts were going off for a completely different reason.
We was talking about a biohazard in Rockdale County.
By the time I looked out, it was like a huge plume.
Do you see this big plume? It's coming towards our direction of our house.
And he was already at the mailbox with a gas mask on. Like, he didn't stay at the door until I answered. And he just yelled, "You need to evacuate."
Rockdale County 911, how can I help you?
We got a prickly pussy and ball up.
Which one?
Oh, plant 12. I'm sorry. Plant 12. I'm out of breath. I'm sorry.
So inside the biolab facility, two workers found that chlorine-based chemicals had mixed with a small amount of water. So they called 911, as you just heard, to report the warehouse was filling with smoke. Within hours, the building was engulfed in flames. Firefighters were able to put out that fire, but later that same day, more material reacted with water, causing a second fire. Outside, the fire caused a giant plume of toxic smoke, forcing shelter-in-place orders and evacuations. Jean Sadler has lived in Conyers for more than 50 years. She actually lives about a minute from that plant. She was one of those who was told to evacuate.
So we're thinking, oh, okay, they'll have it under control by 5 o'clock. So we go to the church and we sat at the church for all those hours. So finally we realize we can't go home. So we go to our daughters.
And we follow Jean all through season one. She talks about living through this fire and others and how it's caused her just so much anxiety. She's in her 70s. She lives on a fixed income. And her main concern is that the wealth that she's built for her family through owning that home that she's had in Conyers for so long has all been wiped out from this fire. So she's really just hoping to be made whole by this company.
In hearing from longtime residents, right, like Jean Sadler, you help us realize that biolabs problems go back a long way, right? How far back do they go?
Yeah, biolab has had a number of incidents at the Conyers facility over the years. So we found 5 major accidents, a 2004 fire that prompted evacuations, a 2015 fire ended up injuring 6 Rockdale County firefighters. That following year, residents near the plant were voluntarily evacuated after a fire was reported. And in 2020, there was another fire, and most recently, 2024. But we also found that the fire exposed gaps in oversight by federal agencies like the Department of Labor's Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. So the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, or CSB, is the non-governmental federal agency that's been investigating this fire as well as these past fires. And they've suggested for decades that chemicals like the one that caught fire in Conyers be subjected to stronger regulation by federal agencies. The problem is that that agency has no teeth. So for all the recommendations that they've been making for 2 decades, they don't have any power to enforce any of them.
And what does Biolab say to that?
Biolab defends its safety record, both in Conyers and in Louisiana, where they have another plant and there was another fire. In a statement, they say they've been rigorous about actioning enhancements to their facilities, policies, and practices. And in Conyers, they say they enacted safety enhancements and implemented more training for employees. The company also says that they're cooperating with federal investigators as these investigations are ongoing.
Have you heard from federal agencies in response to your reporting?
We reached out to the CSB and OSHA, and as both are still investigating, they won't comment until the investigations are complete. So far, the CSB found that the company was storing 14 million pounds of chemicals at the time of the fire in Conyers. And that's more than double, actually, what they told Rockdale County that that warehouse would hold. They haven't determined a cause of the fire. OSHA has actually gone further than the CSB, though. Their agency blames improper chemical storage as the reason for the fire last year. They proposed a $61,000 fine and cited the company for multiple serious violations related to chemical storage, emergency response, and worker protection.
All right, we've been talking to Georgia Public Radio's Pamela Kirkland about her podcast, Manufacturing Danger. And Pamela, you spent time with a number of residents who've been living with the aftermath of the fire. What stands out to you about the residents who claim their health has been affected?
One of the stories that really sticks with me is Cheryl Garcia's. She complained about her asthma and it getting worse after the fire, but she noticed that her voice was weaker and much more raspy following the accident, and she jokingly refers to it as her quote-unquote biolab voice.
Well, I had a referral, actually, from a primary care doc back in November, but I never acted on it because I thought, oh, it'll get better. But I finally decided, no, go ahead and use the referral. And I'm happy I did, because once she did the scope and saw some nodules on my vocal cords and some spots of damage. She said, I can't say that these are burns, but there's clearly some damage to your vocal cords.
One of the things we try to get at in this podcast is just how hard it's been for a lot of these residents to get their doctors to say that the biolab fire was the cause of their symptoms, like hypertension, asthma, or migraines. And it's very hard to prove a connection like that.
Does the company believe those claims that, you know, there has been a health fallout from this fire?
We reached out to Biolab about the health concerns that residents say that they think are a result from the fire, and the company directed me to resource information that's available from Rockdale County, from the EPA. The company did, however, stand up a community assistance center and a hotline not long after the fire to help process claims that were being submitted by residents and also impacted businesses near the plant. They stopped accepting new reimbursement claims about 3 months after the fire.
Pamela, your reporting shows that this is not an isolated case, right? That there's a larger pattern of chemical plant accidents across the country. How did you come across this realization?
Yeah, since the fire, the podcast has focused on communities from other parts of the country reaching out in response. There were actually residents from East Palestine, Ohio, who are still dealing with the fallout from chemical exposure after that 2023 Norfolk Southern train derailment. They were at the Georgia State Capitol and in Conyers for a meeting in December last year to offer support. More recently, in Louisiana, there was a plant explosion that's left the community of Roseland dealing with the fallout of an industrial accident, and Conyers residents are reaching out to them. So it's been kind of cool to see how these communities are really leaning on one another because they don't feel like they can rely solely on state and federal agencies for the response.
Pamela Kirkland is the host of GPB's Manufacturing Danger, the Biolab Story, available wherever you get your podcasts. Season 1 is available now, and you can listen to Season 2 starting on Monday. Pamela, thank you so much for all your reporting on this.
Thank you for having me.
The legendary flight school that trained the first African-American pilots during World War II is taking off with a new generation after 80 years.
We haven't had any flying activity since the airmen, so I was like, why not be a part of something new here at Tuskegee?
Fantasia Smith is a third-year student at Tuskegee University in Alabama.
I have classes, I'm in clubs, I'm flying, and then I also have to do my internship. So it's like a lot on my plate, but it's manageable.
School life keeps her grounded, but outside of class, she's in rarefied air.
Just being in the plane for that first time is just something new and amazing. Like a discovery flight is when I knew that this was for me.
Smith is in the first cohort of Tuskegee University's revamped aeronautical sciences program. The department is giving wings to new commercial licensees.
The more that you fly, the more comfortable you get into it. As I've struggled with stalls, and I remember spending 2 to 3 hours with my instructor practicing stalls and recovering from it. And it's something that you actually have to be proficient and safe in. Otherwise, if you don't know how to recover from it, you can stall the aircraft. And, you know, that'll be your last time, of course, flying.
Real world skills tested to industry standards.
I almost got into a spin, and for me, that was scary because my instructor would kind of let it happen and then sit there and see what I would do to recover.
Takeoffs, piloting in the air, and, you know, what goes up must come down.
The scariest part for me was landing. If the landing isn't great, you can always just do a go around, which is us introducing that power back into the aircraft and just going back into the traffic pattern and trying it again. You can always reject a landing. So for me, it was like, if I didn't like the landing, I can always reject it and go around.
As opposed to takeoffs, which Smith says once you lift the nose and wheels are up, you just kind of gotta commit. Smith, who received her pilot's license this month, says learning to fly is a commitment to the life, so much so that she sometimes forgets to turn off pilot speak when she's out of the cockpit.
So it's definitely changed my life as I do apply aviation into like regular conversations with people. And I remember being in a car with one of my friends and I accidentally said to him, the outside air temperature is 76 degrees. And I just felt so much like a nerd in that moment.
Otherwise, she says her conversations are pretty standard. Music, food. It just rings a bit different when her college buddies ask her for a ride. You've been listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Thanks for tuning in and have a good evening.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. K210 CR in Atchison, 89.9. And K258BT in Manhattan, 99.5. And we're always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us here on a Sunday afternoon. This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on Prairie Paws Animal Shelter. Serving Ottawa, Manhattan, and Emporia, Prairie Paws provides compassionate care for animals in need. Donations help give pets a second chance. More information is available at prairiepaws.org. Tonight in Northeast and East Central Kansas, mostly clear skies, a low of 61 degrees. Sunny for tomorrow with a high of 83. For Monday night, partly cloudy, a low of 61, high of 82 on Tuesday. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
The first thing you need to know about Lori is that normally she's not the kind of girl who does this sort of thing at all. She doesn't write to strangers. She doesn't do fan mail. But she was looking at, you know, the page in certain magazines where the people who write for the magazine? She was looking at that, and she saw the photo of this writer who she liked. The picture was blurry, but he had this intense look in his eye. And you could tell he was smart and cute, both at the same time.
But I saw this picture, and I was like, that guy's my soulmate. And I know that's completely insane, but I knew that I could not not contact him because I would always regret it if I didn't. So I wrote this letter to the magazine, you know, to him, care of the magazine, and I made up a story. I said, I think that, you know, I know this is going to sound really weird, but I saw your picture on the contributors page and you look exactly like this guy that I met in the airport years ago. This is a complete lie.
Right.
So I said, you know, I was changing planes and you were going into one gate and I was going into another. And we struck up this conversation and you were talking about how you wanted to become a writer. And I said, you know, I'm not sure if it's you. I know this sounds really strange, but, you know, if you remember this, let me know. And if it's not you, let me know also, just so that, you know, I know that it wasn't you.
She figured that in the extremely unlikely event that they actually sort of got along, and it led to something bigger, well, then she would admit the truth, and no harm done. Remember, she had never done this kind of scam before. She had no idea how complicated it could get.
So I don't hear from him, which I was relieved by, actually. After I sent the letter, I really regretted actually sending the letter because I was really sort of just embarrassed that I had done this. So then one day, like 3 months later, I get a call, and I was actually waiting for the cable guy. I'd been waiting for like 3 days for the cable guy. So I'm on the phone with the cable company and they're saying the guy in the field is going to call you any second on your call waiting. So we're going to hang on with you while we contact him and he's going to call you. So then my call waiting beeps in and I say hello. And the person says, is this Lori? And I say, yes. And the person says, I'm the guy. And I think he's the cable guy. So I say, where have you been? And he says, I know, I'm really sorry. I meant to contact you earlier. And this whole thing goes back and forth until I realize that he's not the cable guy. So I said, you're not the cable guy? And he says, no, I'm the guy from the airport. And I'm floored because I can't believe, you know, that he's calling me, that I'm actually on the phone with him, that I'm talking to this guy that I was, you know, momentarily obsessed with. And it's him. And he starts to tell me that he's really glad that he heard from me because, yes, he's the guy from the airport. And what a coincidence. He's coming to L.A. to do a story the next day. And can we see each other again? And I'm thinking to myself, again, this didn't happen. And I'm really worried that he thinks that I'm somebody else. Like maybe he met some other girl in the airport a long time ago and he thinks that I'm that girl. And when he meets me, he's going to be really disappointed that I'm not whoever he was thinking of.
Right.
But I also don't want to correct him because then I think if I tell him, you know what, actually I made the whole thing up and I just wanted to get to meet you, he'll think I'm, you know, insane and he won't want to meet me. So I decide that I will meet him, but I will tell him the truth immediately upon meeting him.
Wait, you know, there's a third option, and that is that he knows he didn't meet you, but he just wants to meet a girl.
You know, I thought about that, and there was actually a fourth option, which was he knows that I'm screwing with him, and he's just getting back at me by kind of playing the game.
Wow. I have to say, like you were meeting him, like for him to be the person on the phone when you're expecting the cable guy, did that make it seem more romantic, like you guys were meeting, so cute, or did it make it feel like you didn't even want a deal?
Oh no, the minute I found out that it was him, I completely regressed back into my state of obsession. So, and in terms of meeting cute, actually, he was coming to LA and I was going to New York and we were going to miss each other completely. It was like a romantic comedy, but it turned out that my flight back to LA was an hour before his outgoing flight back to New York. So it turned out we were going to be in the same terminal at the same time at LAX. So he said, wouldn't it be great to meet in the airport again?
Which, of course, was the single most confusing thing that he could possibly say. Because on the one hand, you know, how faded, how romantic comedy can you get, both at the airport, right? And on the other hand, what the hell is he talking about? They've never met. But today on our radio show, we have three stories of mind games. Situations where a simple deception goes way out of hand and leads to all kinds of things that it was never intended to lead to. You're listening to This American Life, by the way, from WBEZ Chicago. I'm Ira Glass. Lori's story continues after the break. Stay with us.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for This American Life here on a Sunday evening. Here at KPR, we have one job, to serve our listeners with exceptional news, culture, and ideas. Your donation directly funds the service that you rely on. Because you listen to KPR, please consider becoming a member listener at support.kansaspublicradio.org to help fund the programming that matters. Thanks to all of you for all that you do to support KPR. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, skies clear, a low of 61 degrees. Sunny tomorrow, a high of 83. For Monday night, partly cloudy, a low of 61. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
This American Life, I'm Ira Glass. Today's show is a rerun. We are in the middle of our story about Lori. She and the stranger, if you remember, were going to meet in the airport in Los Angeles. But then, a snag. Her travel plans change. She cannot meet the guy at the airport. And so instead, she shows up. She has a drink with him at his hotel. And the first surprise is, he looks nothing, nothing like his picture.
And I didn't quite know what to do about that because he looked so unlike his picture. But at that point, I wondered if he was actually the guy or if he had sent, like, he was playing a mind game with me and he had sent some other guy to kind of go on the date with me.
Wow. I love how because you're running a con, suddenly you believe everybody's running a con.
Well, your sense of reality gets turned upside down. It's like you think I'm an honest person and I did this. So who knows what other people are doing?
So she sits there, And the longer she sits there, the more that she could see that, yes, when he turns his head this particular way, he probably is the guy in the photo. Not that that helps anything. She is not liking the real him. Not attracted.
And because I'm not interested, I'm kind of deciding, do I need to even tell him that I made this up? Or can I just leave?
Oh, right.
He doesn't need to know that I made up the story. But then on the other hand, it was sort of strange because he kept talking about our encounter in the airport. And it was kind of frustrating to me because I felt like, why is he doing this? I couldn't understand why he would do this. It wasn't just that he had seen my letter and kind of went with it. It was like he then took the letter to a whole new level of deception. First, he said when I met him at the bar, the first thing he said to me was, oh, I recognized you immediately. You look exactly the same as you did in the airport. Then when we were talking, he'd just like pepper the conversation with all these little lies. Like he said that when we were in the airport, he remembered that I was confused about what I wanted to do with my life. So he says to me, you know, the bar closes and he says, you know, do you want to come up and continue talking? And I wanted to leave really badly at that point, but because I'd been there for so many hours, I thought I cannot leave and not find out, not get to the bottom of this story. And I feel so guilty at this point that I really feel like I have to come clean.
Right.
So I go upstairs and I say to him, you know, I have to tell you, I really don't think that you're the guy from the airport. It's been really nice meeting you, but you're not the guy. And he says, no, I am. And he's very insistent about it. And it's sort of like once he had his own position, he didn't want to change his position. So I say to him, you know, actually, it really wasn't you because I made the whole thing up. And he is stunned into silence. And I think, oh, God, he thinks I'm a freak. And I'm sitting there thinking, I just want to, like, crawl into a hole right now. I should never have told him the truth. And then he just looks at me very calmly and says, no, you didn't. I remember this. And I look at him like, what is he doing? I can't imagine what he's doing. Why is he doing that? Is he trying to save face for me? And he was he wasn't like excited about it. He was like cool as a cucumber. He was like, no, it happened. I remember. And it was like, it made me seem crazy.
Yeah.
You know, like all of a sudden it's like, you know how you appear crazier when you're trying to prove to somebody that you're not crazy?
Yes.
And basically I said, look, I gotta go. And oddly, he said at the door, he's like, can I kiss you? And I just gave him my cheek, and then he gave me his card, and I left.
But there are only two possibilities. Either he actually believes that he met you, or he knows he didn't, right?
Right, but let's say that he believed that he met me. Reverse the situation. If somebody said to me, you know, I think I met you in the airport, and I believe them, and then they said I made it all up, I would believe them. I would say, oh, huh. You know, I thought that actually you were telling the truth, but if you say you made it up, you must have made it up. Like, what would be my motive for telling him I made the whole thing up?
Yeah, I find that very convincing, actually. I wasn't actually sure what I thought up until you said that, but actually now I actually believe that he completely knew that he was lying. I actually believe there's no chance that he actually thought he met you.
There's no reason for him not to believe me, except for the fact that I've already established myself as a liar because I'm telling him I lied and sent you this note that was a complete lie.
I love how like this started off as like this innocent little romantic lie. And then before it's done, like you yourself are caught up in this whole like world of where you can't even figure out how to convince him and you can't figure out why he's saying what he's saying. Like your mind is so messed with by the end of this story.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of it. I mean, years later, I don't know what to make of it. It's this thing that I sort of, whatever went on in that room that night, it's like it stayed with me for so many years because it was so confusing to me.
Lori Gottlieb, she's now a psychotherapist in Los Angeles. She's written a number of books, and these days she also writes the Ask the Therapist column in the New York Times. back to The Spy Who Loved Everyone. Today's program is a rerun. We first aired this back in 2005, and we now turn to this story about good intentions and where they lead from Jorge Just.
It's a Saturday in January, dead of winter. A crowded subway car. New York City.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
At the Canal Street station, a guy walks onto the car. He's wearing a hat, gloves, scarf, and coat. But no pants. At the next stop, Spring Street, someone else gets on with no pants. This continues for a half dozen stops. The car's filling up with pantsless people who don't seem to know or even notice each other. Reactions vary. Some riders avert their eyes, some laugh out loud, some stare, turn away, stare again. Finally, at 33rd Street, somebody new comes through the car. It's a vendor. She's selling pants.
Short pants, medium pants.
Anyone need pants?
$1.
Tall man on the train.
It won't shock you to know that this whole scene was staged. The pantsless people are part of a group called Improv Everywhere, led by a New Yorker named Charlie Todd. He pulls stunts like this all over New York. He calls them missions. The people that carry them out are called agents. Here's how Charlie explains it.
It's always hard for me to describe it because I always want to use the word prank. But prank always has that negative connotation of, in order for there to be a prank, there has to be a victim. Somebody who has been fooled and has been embarrassed or humiliated or had the best of. And what we try to do is really the opposite. We try to make people happy.
For Charlie, happy means fun. And fun means making strange things happen in boring locations. Take Mission 27, the Mobius.
The Mobius mission was a time loop in a Starbucks.
It worked like this. Charlie and six friends choreographed a 5-minute sequence of events to repeat over and over again. They planned it at a Starbucks, and they performed it at another, the one across the street. Each agent had their own action. Charlie and his girlfriend started off. They walk in and get in line. Charlie notices a pack of cigarettes in her purse and confronts her about her smoking.
She says, you know, don't tell me what to do, and storms out of the Starbucks. And I run out after her, yelling her name, Katie, come back. And then 4 minutes later, we walk back into the Starbucks, get in line again. And so that's our loop.
Agent number 3 spills his water, stands up, gets napkins, comes back to clean up the mess, and repeats. That's his loop. Agent number 4 answers a phone call, walks through the window for better reception, then goes back to his chair. Agent number 5 gets up to go to the bathroom, decides the line is too long, returns to his seat. Agent number 6 simply sneezes at a precise moment.
And the capper, was my friend Ken, would walk through the Starbucks with a boombox playing Shiny Happy People by R.E.M. And he would walk in one door, go through the entire restaurant, walk out the other door. We repeated that sequence 12 times in a row for an hour total.
Charlie says that for the first few repetitions, nobody noticed a thing. It was the argument between Charlie and his girlfriend that finally caught people's attention.
By the third or fourth time that I had run out the Starbucks chasing after my girlfriend, people were starting to say if I was him, I'd just break up with her, But it wasn't that they thought that they were in a time loop. It was that they thought that we really just kept getting into a fight. And then by the fifth and sixth time that we did it, people kind of started to get freaked out. There was one woman in particular who we had on the hidden camera who called her friend and said, you have to come down here. I'm at the Starbucks in Astor Place. I don't know what's going on.
I don't know if you've ever been in a Starbucks, but if you do go, you'll notice lots of people doing the same sort of thing over and over again. Sip the coffee, read the paper, update the blog. Stare hard enough and everyone looks like they're in a time loop. It took people almost an hour to find the line between stage, scene, and reality.
By the end of it, by the ninth and tenth time we're doing it, the whole Starbucks is talking to each other, participating in this thing. It's almost as if everybody in that Starbucks felt like they could predict the future. And they started kind of conducting it. Like they would point at Chris and say, oh, and he's going to sneeze right now. And here comes the boombox guy again. And oh, that means the couple's coming back. And there they are, you know. And then after the 12th time, we just left.
In a way, this might be the most surprising part of the Mobius mission. After going to that much trouble just to provide a room full of strangers with an unforgettable memory, the members of Improv Everywhere get up and they leave. And not just because you can't close a curtain on a coffee shop time loop. Charlie posts pictures and descriptions of the missions on his website, but that's as close as he gets to a standing ovation. He's got loftier goals anyway.
I want to live in a world where anything can happen. I guess what I mean by that is, I don't know, I guess we shouldn't have to rely on, television or movies to, show us, fantastic things and fantastic stories, you know? Let's attempt to bring some of that, excitement to the real world, I guess.
Charlie's missions are cool, but it's his objective that's intriguing. To create fun, inexplicable experiences for random strangers. It's like giving people a small, unexpected gift, and in the process, making the world seem a bit more enchanted. But as anyone who's read a children's book can attest, mess with the forces of enchantment, and things can go terribly, terribly wrong. That's what happened with a mission Charlie calls the best gig ever.
The best gig ever, an idea. My friend Mark Lee came up to me one night, and he came up to me and said, let's find a rock band, a struggling rock band, and give them the greatest gig of their life. So I researched on the internet for the next couple of weeks trying to find the perfect gig, the perfect band who I knew was setting themselves up for just a horrible audience. And I found this band, Ghost of Pasha, from Vermont. Never heard of them before. Nobody in New York had probably heard of them, apart from their friends, because it was their first tour ever. And they had just recorded some songs this summer, and they were going to tour in October. And they were playing a gig in New York on Friday night at 8 o'clock for a $5 cover. Then they had a gig two nights later on Sunday night at the Mercury Lounge for an $8 cover at 10 p.m. So I knew even if they had friends in New York, those friends would come to the Friday night show and they would not come back, no matter how good the show was. They're not coming out at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night to support their friends again.
Charlie recruited 35 agents to act as hardcore Ghost of Pasha fans. They downloaded the 6 songs on the band's website, and they memorized the lyrics. They had t-shirts and temporary tattoos using the Ghost of Pasha logo. They timed their arrival, getting to the club as the next to last band was getting off the stage.
People entered separately or in pairs, didn't act like we knew each other. And by the time they were doing their sound check, they were, all of us were in the room. Not only were they getting ready to perform, we were getting ready to perform too. And everybody from the previous gig had left. They had 3 paying customers that night, not counting us. But instead they had 38, the 35 of us and the 3 paying customers. And once they got on stage and said, hello, Mercury Lounge, or whatever they said, we definitely exploded.
You're listening to footage from a video camera that one of Charlie's friends snuck into the Mercury. The club was dark and the camera was hidden in a bag. At first you can't make anything out, but then the camera goes into night vision mode and it's all there in black and pale green and white. 35 people isn't much of a crowd, but somehow they make it seem like the place is packed. I sat and watched the video with Charlie, who pointed out his favorite moments and showed me how the agents reacted to the music in their own particular ways, some pushing to the front, others hanging back. He points at another guy near the front of the stage. He's dancing spastically, flinging his arms, shaking to the music.
At a show, there is always that one guy who's dancing too much. And the guy we're looking at now, he's that guy, you know? So it's appropriate. We're not all doing it, but he is.
Charlie spends most of the show taking pictures. Each rock crowd has one of those kids, too. But at a certain moment, even he gets swept up in the excitement and starts acting more like he does when he's seeing his favorite band, The Cure.
I will say that, this moment right here, I am definitely, into the show.
What
we were requesting songs. You know, we only knew the names of like six songs because they only had six songs on their EP, which they had on their website. And I was like screaming for. They have a song called "What About the Shut-ins." It's like, "What about the shut-ins of the Second World War?" And I was screaming for shut-ins. I was just yelling, "Shut-ins, shut-ins!" And they played it. I think probably coincidentally they were playing it next in the set. And I just went crazy when they started. When I heard the first notes, I was like, "Yeah, I got my request."
Where's the difference in really, really being into a band and pretending to be really into a band?
Yeah, there's not much difference for that night. It felt just like I was at a Cure show singing along to Just Like Heaven. You know, I was at Ghost of Pasha singing along to What About the Shut-ins. You know, it was whatever. It's the same thing, basically.
The band gets off stage, and Charlie and company leave the bar to go celebrate another mission accomplished. A couple of days later, he puts up pictures and reports of the evening on his website. Charlie figured the band would find his page in a month or two. It's basically inevitable once he's posted everything online. What he wasn't sure of is how they would react.
When I would tell people this idea, like as I was preparing for this event, one of the main responses I got was people saying, like, "That is so cruel. You know, what's going to happen when this band does their gig, their next gig in New York City, and nobody shows up? That is the cruelest thing I've ever heard." And I really don't buy into that logic. I think, you know, I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing to think about. Like, is it cruel to give somebody the best day of their life just because they'll never have another day like that again? You know, and I don't think so. You know, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, you have a wonderful dream and you wake up and do you wish you just have bad dreams every night, you know? Or is it, you know, and I think it's great to have wonderful dreams. And yeah, it kind of sucks for a second, but you'll always have that moment.
We got punked. That show at the Mercury Lounge was a fake. And like, it just like seemed like a blow. Like it was like a blow to my heart.
This is Chris Partika, the guitarist of Ghost of Pasha. It turns out that finding Charlie's website was a bit worse than waking from a dream, and it happened faster than Charlie expected. Lead singer Milo Finch found out only 3 days after the show. His discovery was a disturbing capper to an already long and bizarre few days. To understand how weird this was for the band, you need to hear the story from their perspective. They hadn't even wanted to play the Mercury show in the first place. They were exhausted. They'd just driven from Vermont to Boston for a show Thursday, and to New York for a show on Friday. Ezra the drummer and Brad the bassist had then driven the 6 hours back to Vermont on Saturday and then turned around and returned Sunday. Milo stayed in New York, but he'd been up all night partying.
I remember being on the street before the Mercury Lounge show, completely exhausted, just sitting on the street waiting to play. We didn't even want to do it. But, you know, I remember just sitting there and it was pretty dead. And I knew we thought it was just going to be dead. And we were like, cool, it'll be dead. We could just go up there and play and just get out of here.
Get it over with.
It turns out that the band Charlie picked wasn't just obscure. It was practically brand new. They'd only been together a couple of months. This was their fourth show ever, the third on their tour.
It was really weird, because we knew this was our third show. I remember turning to the drummer, to Ezra, and being like, what's going on? Like in the middle of a song, like a drum break.
What started weird soon got weirder. Keep in mind, they hadn't put out an album. Nobody anywhere had ever heard of them. But somehow, a crowd of New Yorkers knew their lyrics.
The first song we noticed it was in New York, New York. It's one of our songs, and right off the bat is the chorus, and they came right in with it. Like, I think they came in with it on better timing than I did. They came in right in, and they nailed it. Honestly, it was really odd. I mean, there was moments where guys were ripping off their shirts and swinging them over their heads in, like, a helicopter fashion. There were girls that were, like, pointing at the stage and, like, interacting with me, like, as we were pointing back, kind of like... It was just, like, it was bedlam. The exclamation point on the whole evening for me was when the... how creepy it was when the guy jumped up on stage with no shirt. And I just remember him being up front the whole time, punching the air and spinning in circles, and like, it was all sweaty. And he jumped up on stage at the end of the last song and like hugged me. He's all sweaty and clammy. And he's like, thank you. Like, he just kept saying thank you in my ear. And I was just like, all right, thank you. You know what
Agent
I mean?
Agent V.
Like, yeah, Agent V. He seemed like he wasn't really acting and just getting it out, you know?
The band got into it too. Milo's favorite moment came at the end of the set.
During the solo in Power Bitch, I had kind of just laid on the stage, and the crowd rushed the stage and was like grabbing my hands like this, you know, like, because I was right on the lip of the stage. I put the microphone out into the audience and they were screaming and, you know, like grabbing at, you know, my hand and touching the microphone, and made sure I like slapped every hand that came up, you know, just so no one felt like they didn't get it, you know. And however the act was going on or whatever they were pulling or whatever they were doing, I felt that at that point in the show, we answered it back with something real, you know, and everybody was, at that point, everybody in the room was on the same page.
The show was exhausting. They'd played the tour's first ever encore and left all the energy they had on stage. Like Milo said, when a crowd screams at you like you're the Beatles, you act like you're the Beatles. Only this crowd stopped screaming the moment the last notes were played. Chris remembers unplugging his amp, looking up, and being shocked that the place was empty. Ghosts of Pasha were suddenly alone.
I remember we were all standing out on the street smoking our cigarette after the show, and I'm totally confused.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of speechless for a little bit. I think Brad broke the silence. He's always good for breaking the silence. He was like, what the f*** just happened? What the hell was that? I think was the, what the hell was that? As he was lighting his cigarette. It was just creepy.
Creepy, but also pretty sweet.
You know, like, we just, like, had nothing in our heads, so we just decided to fill it with, well, okay, we're really excited, and we're in a really good mood, so this is great. You know, like, finally, 35 people from New York City randomly came to our show and knew our words and stuff, and that's a good feeling.
You know what it was? I think some of the talking was we were addicted to it. We were like, that felt really cool. Like, let's play like that all the time. Like, let's get shows like that all the time, you know?
That warm feeling lasted exactly 3 days, until somebody emailed them a link to Charlie's site. The band met up at the local computer lab and read it together. The next 48 hours were the worst. Email poured in mocking Ghost of Pasha. Their website's bulletin board was flooded with people making fun of them. It got so bad they had to shut it down. The band felt like the butt of a big joke. They struggled to take it all in stride, but inevitably one member would get mad and the others would have to talk him down. A couple of hours later, they'd be on the phone with each other again, making each other angry, calming each other down. The guitarist Chris Partica was most affected. He got teased a lot as a kid, which is why he started playing music in the first place. It was something he could do by himself, in his room, where nobody could make fun of him. News of the prank hit Chris pretty hard.
It's the worst thing I could possibly think of ever happening to me in my life, because I've been avoiding confrontation my whole life so I wouldn't get made fun of. And the moment I decide that I want to try and be real and do what I really want to do, all of a sudden it's reacted in the same way as it was when I was like in kindergarten. And it's just like, what is the difference? You know, I'm 30 years old now and I'm still getting made fun of by people.
Knowing all this, it's surprising how Chris feels about it now, 6 months after it happened.
It was a gift. It was the gift of, like, yeah, everything's okay. At this point, I don't really feel like anything can hurt me. Because I've dealt with what I've never thought that I could deal with before. It was like psychotherapy for my childhood. You know what I mean? Like, everybody in the world look at Chris and everyone was like, duh, look at him, duh, you know, like, and then what am I supposed to do with that? But be like, hey, how you doing? I'm Chris. I play the guitar and I like it.
After mulling it over for a few days, the band decided what to do. They wrote into Charlie's website with their own enthusiastic reports of the evening. Brad the bassist was terse, Chris the guitarist was thoughtful, and Milo the lead singer was the lead singer. Here's Charlie.
The lead singer was like, was really enthusiastic, and upbeat about the whole thing. But you could tell that he had definitely had like, if not an ego, definitely had like a lot of pride in the band, and made that clear too. And, there's one, you know, he had one line, in his report that said like, you know, no matter what happened, we rocked the house that night and you knew it. But, so he did say, there were elements of like, you know, we realized that it was a prank, but just so you know, we did rock it, you know, and which like, I agree with them. They did. They rocked it.
They rocked the show and snatched the opportunity. Bands need publicity, and Ghosts of Pasha knew a happy story sells better than a sad one. And they were right. The band was interviewed in Spin magazine. An A&R guy gave them a call. In other words, Ghosts of Pasha played along. They took Charlie's story about what happened that night and made it their own. But not everybody's ready to make themselves at home in Charlie's world. Some people prefer their life just the way it is.
All right, my name's Christopher Rawson. I am a fine arts student. I'm going to New York University. And they basically threw me a fake birthday party.
The idea was to throw a birthday party for a stranger. Go up to someone in a bar at random and act like it was his birthday.
Charlie gathered about 30 Improv Everywhere agents and headed to a bar called Dempsey's to pick the evening star. He decided on Chris, who was sitting with a friend and a full pitcher of beer. It looked like they were settling in for the night. Charlie called the other agents and described Chris, and then he walked over and started the party.
And I said, hey, Ted, how's it going? Sorry we're a little early for your birthday party, but thank you for inviting us.
They came up to me and they were like, you know, just really addressed me as this other person, as Ted. And we're just like, you know, hey, what's up, buddy? You know, happy birthday.
You know, and he looks at me, and at first he thinks it's just a case of misunderstanding. You know, he's like, oh, I'm sorry, you got the wrong guy. I'm not Ted. And I just laughed and said, you know, that's really funny, Ted. You did invite us to your birthday party. We got the Evite.
A few minutes later, more people started coming in and everybody was wishing me happy birthday and calling me by Ted. And everybody seemed to have this memory or this, you know, experience that they had with me in the past, which obviously was completely foreign to me.
I had sent out an email to everybody involved with some specifics about this guy, Ted Hine. And said that he was 25 years old, that he went to UNC Chapel Hill, that he worked at Oppenheimer Funds, that his favorite band was Dave Matthews. Like, we came up with all these specifics about him. And I told everybody, like, you know, pick out what your relationship is to Ted. Figure out what your story is and stick to it.
People were giving me hugs and being like, oh, I haven't seen you in so long. What have you been up to? And they had all kind of brought in little gift cards. And on all of them, they said, you know, remember spring break, you know, things relating to school. A few of the people thought I worked for some sort of bank or something.
And he got really freaked out, which I didn't necessarily anticipate, but looking back on it, I guess I probably should have anticipated that that would freak somebody out.
I was definitely freaked out and suspicious. I mean, It seemed very confrontational and very grotesque, even, I would say. So yeah, it was kind of like a really bad dream.
Chris, it turns out, wasn't the brash 25-year-old East Villager that Charlie thought he'd chosen. He was actually a college student, a very young one, who'd recently transferred to NYU. If Charlie's the kind of guy who goes out in the world and makes things happen, then Chris is the kind who stays closer to home. He's thoughtful and sensitive and shy. Chris likes to have things in a certain understandable order, and Charlie wasn't part of it.
There was no sense that, you know, it was kind of a charade. I mean, it all felt very natural. It felt really close to reality, but yet it was so strange and different that it couldn't be. So there was definitely the worry, too, on my part, I guess, that I was going insane, maybe, because it made no sense. So I kind of felt like I was losing my mind in that sense, like the ability to rationalize what was happening, because I really couldn't.
He showed them his driver's license, but they laughed it off. And Chris couldn't shake the feeling that a guy named Ted, the real Ted, could show up at any moment to find Chris drinking Ted's free drinks, and even worse, blowing out Ted's candles and eating Ted's cake. But every time he tried to leave, a fake friend would stop him, beg him to stay, buy him a drink. Eventually, he just became Ted.
It was pretty much my only option, and I think that was the moment of with Shift, was kind of realizing that, you know, I was like, okay, well, if they all think I'm Ted, then what the hell? And just kind of played along with it, you know. I think I just kind of decided that maybe I could, by assuming that identity, have some control or some say in the situation.
You know, it was, like, disappointing at first to see this guy get freaked out. I was like, oh, no, like, my whole idea is to make this guy's night. To watch that transformation to the guy playing pool, doing shots, and getting phone numbers was really a blast to watch. And I can't decide in the end whether I picked, like, the perfect guy or whether I picked the worst guy.
There may have been a worse Ted somewhere in the world, but probably not in that bar. Sure, he'd had fun, even let them convince him to take the gift cards home. Chris rose to the challenge and became Ted. But by the next morning, he was Chris again. Only he was Chris with another man's gift cards.
I don't know, they became kind of this, like, weird collection of sacred objects, almost, you know? Like, for a year, you know, I kind of, like, saw them as this, like, you know, other, these empowered things.
Right. It's sort of like in the sci-fi movie when you, you know, you come back from...
Right,
back
it's
in
like,
time, and you reach in your pocket, and you still have the arrowhead
right,
or whatever.
Right, exactly. Or when Tom Cruise wakes up in Eyes Wide Shut, and the mask from the night before is on his pillow. You know, as much as I wanted to forget it, you know, I woke up and those gift cards were there. You know, it was like, oh, I guess that did happen.
Chris's response over time was different from Ghost of Pasha's. They came to appreciate the idea in their own way, but it just left Chris feeling vulnerable and a little paranoid. He hated the thought that all those strangers at the bar could just pop up again at any moment. One day, he was sitting on a bench in Union Square when a guy walked up to him and said, "Hey, Ted." He waved him off, but it was freaky. It didn't help that his memory of the whole thing was a little hazy. For example, he didn't remember giving his phone number out to anyone that night. So you can imagine how he felt when Charlie called him a year later.
And I said, "Hey, Ted, it's Charlie. How's it going? Your birthday's coming up in a few weeks. We want to know, celebrate it. We want to throw you another party. Wanted to know what you wanted. Like, last year we got you those Best Buy gift certificates. Do you want that again, or is there a different store? Give me a call back." And I gave my number. I didn't hear from him. And as it turns out, a friend of mine know someone who's a bartender at Dempsey's, where we did Ted's birthday. And Ted is still a regular at that bar, I assume. And he told this bartender, he went up to her and said, "Do you know the people who did that birthday thing to me last year?" And he said, "Well, could you tell them to stop calling me? And if they're going to be coming around this bar, I'm going to have to stop coming here." It really kind of broke my heart because it had been such like a wonderful night and a wonderful experience for us. And it seemed like it had been a wonderful experience for him.
But I mean, but is it, I mean, did it go well? Is it a success if, you know, if a year later Ted's story has changed?
Well, I mean, it does kind of like, that response definitely made me sad. But regardless of how he feels about it now, I do know that night was awesome, you know. In the end, I mean, I kind of sound like, you know, the lead singer of Ghost of Pasha now. Like, I want to tell him and kind of say the same things to him that guy said to me, you know, like, you know, whatever you say, you had a blast that night, you know. But he did. He did get his $300, and he did get completely drunk and make friends, even if for only a night. So, like, that night as it exists in my memory and in the memory of everybody who's there, like, was a success. Did I see you cry?
Were you crying like a girl? Like in the end, Chris did to Charlie what Charlie does so well to other people. He pretended to have an experience that he wasn't actually having. And Charlie thought the fake-out was real. And when he found out the truth, Charlie reacted the way other people do to him in that situation. He was sort of upset, a little hurt. And then he comforted himself by deciding that some part of the fake-out was real. And that's the danger of what Charlie does. He believes you'll enjoy sharing his fantasy world, whether you do or not. He asks you to leave your own reality and step into his. Just like every crazy pantsless guy in the subway.
Jorge, just, we first aired this story back in 2005. Ghost of Pasha is still a band. They even performed at an Improv Everywhere anniversary show once. And Milo, the lead singer, actually went out to join some missions as an agent with Improv Everywhere. Improv Everywhere is still operating. Their website, improveverywhere.com. Coming up, mind games that can turn a girl invisible in front of a neighborhood, a city, and the national media. That's in a minute from Chicago Public Radio when our program continues.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 89.7 Emporia, and always online at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for This American Life here on a Sunday evening. As part of KPR's annual Live Day broadcast on Friday night, October 24th, join us for a free concert by violinist Destiny Ann Remagen and friends. It's an evening of spooky tales and tunes, live at Lawrence Public Library and broadcast on KPR stations. That's on Friday night, October 24th at 7 p.m. The admission's free, but we ask you to RSVP at kansaspublicradio.org if you plan on joining us. Mostly clear skies tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, a low of 61 degrees. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
This is American Life from Ira Glass. Each week on the program, of course, we choose some theme, bring you a variety of different kinds of stories on that theme. Today's show, Mind Games. This is a rerun. We've arrived at Act 3 of our program. Act 3, Invisible Girl. You may remember the story of Elizabeth Smart. In recent days, she's an activist and she's on TV sometimes and she does all sorts of stuff. But back in 2002, she was abducted from her home in Salt Lake City by a man who believed that God had told him to take her as his wife. She was 14 at the time. He was 49, and he already had a wife, Wanda, who was 57 years old. His name was Brian David Mitchell, but he called himself Emmanuel. Thousands of volunteers searched for Elizabeth Smart. For months, her picture was everywhere. It was a big story. Now we know that 2 months after the kidnapping, Mitchell and Wanda brought Elizabeth to the place that nobody would expect them to go, downtown Salt Lake City. Right in the middle of the whole thing. They walked the streets. Nobody recognized her. And at that time, back in 2002, one of the contributors to our show, Scott Carrier, lived in that same neighborhood, the one that Elizabeth Smart lived in, the one where her captors had brought her. And once the truth came out, back then, Scott talked to his neighbors about what happened in their heads, that they did not recognize her. Here he is.
Our neighborhood is on a hillside, sandwiched between the University of Utah and downtown, the closest thing we've got here to a liberal enclave, and relatively diverse, at least economically. At the bottom of the hill are the mansions built in the late 1800s, the street lined with old sycamores, some shops and stores, apartment buildings. Going up the hillside, the houses generally get newer and bigger. Elizabeth Smart and her family lived about a mile from our house. After she was abducted, her picture seemed to be everywhere, taped to light posts and every storefront window. She was on the news every day for months. But she was here with her two abductors, walking around on the streets, and nobody figured it out. Nobody recognized her, partly because they were disguised. They wore white robes. Elizabeth and Wanda had their heads covered, veils across their faces, revealing only their eyes. Mitchell, or Emmanuel, had a turban, a long beard, and a walking stick. For 2.5 months, from August until October, they stayed pretty much right in the neighborhood, and a lot of people saw them.
Yeah, I did. I saw them. I saw them walking. I was at the gas station, and we were washing the car.
Yeah, they were walking right past Blockbuster Video, right towards the supermarket.
And we were up on 4th South at the Wendy's.
And we went in there for a second to see if they had a salad bar. And they didn't. But on the way out, he came up, Emmanuel, or Brian David Mitchell.
And they're all wearing their robes. And they're walking slowly up the street. I don't know where they're going in a single file line.
I saw him, and the guy, he stopped and he started talking to somebody. I think he asked for a cigarette.
And the two women stood back a little bit, and he came up, and he was very humble, and he asked for some money for food. He didn't seem threatening.
But I saw the girl, you know, eye to eye, and she looked familiar. Even that, her pictures were in the door, you know? But it did not click, you know? It did not click.
It wasn't like they just showed up out of nowhere. Mitchell and Barzee had been homeless, on the street, wearing the robes for a couple of years before they took Elizabeth. My friend Trent Harris thought he knew the guy all too well.
Well, he was kind of a fixture on the streets of Salt Lake City. He was always asking for money in front of the ZCMI shopping mall. I remember he'd sit out there with this just pathetic look on his face. Oh, he was annoying. He was really annoying.
I'd seen him before. I thought they were just crazy, extremists, fundamentalists who walk around.
That's my son Milo. He's the same age as Elizabeth and went to grade school with her. We have a picture of Milo and Elizabeth at a birthday party when they were four. He's dressed as a cowboy. She's a princess. My wife Hillary gave her dance lessons. In September, Milo saw Elizabeth with Mitchell and Barzee when he was at a gas station washing the car.
They walked by me. I was within 10 feet of them. I'm pretty sure she could have recognized me if she'd just seen me. I bet she did.
But she didn't say anything, and Milo didn't recognize her.
I didn't think anything of it. Because that's ridiculous. Like, she's walking around in the middle of daylight. It wouldn't be her. Like, it didn't even cross my mind that it would be her. Who would do that? Who would actually take the person that everybody's looking for, like, the most sought-after person in the whole state, pretty much? That's risking your life. If somebody found him and, like, recognized her, they would have killed him. Right?
Part of the reason the disguise worked is because whether we saw him as a pest or a harmless eccentric or a crazy fundamentalist, we saw him as a loser, someone to be pitied or scorned, written off, ignored, forgotten. And we don't really look at people like that. We look away. There's another reason we didn't recognize Elizabeth, and it has to do with a thing that's specific to this culture and this place, right here. In any other state, if you saw Mitchell and Barzee walking along with a young girl in tow, you'd think it was their daughter. But when we saw it here, we thought she was his new polygamous wife.
And I remember saying to myself, you know, I'm used to seeing Emmanuel David with one woman, but now he had two, and the other one was much younger, and I remember thinking, how did he manage to pull that off?
And when he came up to us the day at Wendy's, I felt bad for those two women.
Here's my friend, Dana Costello.
And I especially noticed that the other one was young, but I didn't think that's their daughter. I assumed immediately, just in my head, that she was his new wife. It just came to my head, oh, look, he got another wife.
He didn't think anything bad about it. When you saw they had two wives.
I didn't. I really didn't.
Officially, the Mormons stopped believing in polygamy in 1890, but it still goes on here and there, and many people in Salt Lake City have polygamous ancestors. And when we run into it, there's a sense of shame and embarrassment mixed in with American ideals of freedom of religion. And the end result is we just ignore it and let it be. We don't want to look at it. What's especially annoying about this is the possibility that Mitchell was smart enough to figure it out and use this weakness against us. The most amazing encounter with Elizabeth happened in September, not long before the threesome left town to spend the winter in Southern California. There was a party in a big house full of bohemians. Mitchell, Barzee, and Elizabeth were walking by, maybe on their way back to their camp in the foothills, and they stopped in. Amber Merriweather and Russell Farrell were there that night.
There's always people in costumes at the parties there. So we
just thought that they were just people in costume, you know, just being silly.
He drew a lot of attention to himself because he had a lot of preaching going on. He was an obvious preacher, but it seemed dichotomous that he was, meanwhile, bumming beers.
It looked like he had never seen food or drink in his entire life. You know, the man was, like, obviously starving and a complete obnoxious drunk.
Somebody at the party took a picture of Elizabeth standing there in the kitchen. You may have seen it. A veil across her face, her eyes so clearly now, the same eyes in the posters hanging up all over town. The people at the party were so close, but still they couldn't see her. It was just too absurd. Amber even went up and talked to her.
I walked into the kitchen, and I remember looking at her a couple times and thinking that she looked familiar. I'd been seeing her pictures everywhere, but I didn't connect the two. I just thought, I mean, come on, you're not going to think Elizabeth Smart's going to be drunk at a party. Or I guess she wasn't drunk. I don't think she drank anything, actually. But I walked up to her, and I just asked her, where do I know her from, that she looks really familiar. And she didn't really say anything back. And the man, Emmanuel, came up. He said, no, you don't know her.
Someone said, well, was this guy using some sort of black magic over the whole scenario? Putting a veil, so to speak, over everyone's perception. His approach to her and the other woman was very, he was quite the patriarch.
I think he was so believing of his righteousness or his potency of his prophecy. And he would do these little things to prove to himself more and more so that he was being protected by God because it was right what he was doing. That every time he took Elizabeth out and that she wasn't noticed, it was true that Elizabeth was his. And he really believed that he could be protected in this way, that he made it happen in this weird way. It did happen. He had literally put a spell over Salt Lake City that no one would see him. It was magical. I think he believed that.
I think it's more likely we didn't see Elizabeth because we thought the guy who took her would be a monster, a boogeyman, and we expected him to appear in that form. Mitchell looked like the opposite of a boogeyman. A boogeyman stands in the shadows and jumps out at you. Mitchell stood right in front of us and sort of became invisible. When Elizabeth was discovered 9 months after her abduction, we all realized our mistake, and it was like a combination of being really happy she was alive, mixed with feelings of being duped in a rather serious and sinister way. We realized we were partly to blame, that there was something within us that made us deny the obvious, and that hurt. My son Milo thought about it for months afterwards. He's 17 now.
Did you feel bad when you realized that you'd missed it?
Yeah.
Tell me what you felt like when you heard it.
When I heard that he was walking around with that guy, I was like, holy crap, I've been right there. Like, I've walked by those guys and just passed it off as nothing. Like, not like what? It sounds bad, but the way that he kept her was, he convinced her to stay with him. He took her up into the mountains, he's not a good guy. He's a terrible person. But took her up into the mountains and somehow brainwashed her, or convinced her that she was meant to be with him and he was the son of God, right? He thinks he's Jesus. If I could have been there, if I had known then, if I'd just been able to think about it, or I don't know. It made me pretty angry. Like, maybe if I could just go back to then, that day. Thinking about that more than anything.
I saw Elizabeth a couple weeks ago, downtown between the shopping malls. She was on one side of the street, and I was on the other. At first, I thought she was a woman in her 20s, maybe a legal secretary, because that's how she was dressed. But then when the light changed and we walked by each other, I thought, who is that? She looks like a young Muriel Hemingway, really distinctive and beautiful eyes. And then I realized it was Elizabeth Smart, right as she went by me. It was like seeing a rock star or a mythic heroine. She'd journeyed to a dark world, and it seemed, looking at her, that she'd come back with her innocence intact. And this made me feel hopeful, like maybe things are going to turn out okay.
Scott Carrier. His podcast, Home of the Brave, just started season 5. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts.
Old black magic has me in a spell.
Old black magic that you weave so well.
Our program was produced today by Jane Marie and myself. Our website, thisamericanlife.org. This American Life is delivered to public radio stations by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Support for This American Life comes from Odoo. Odoo streamlines every aspect of your company in one simple and efficient business management platform. More information at odoo.com. That's O-D-O-O.com. And for Progressive Insurance, Snapshot from Progressive gives you a personalized rate based on actual driving habits. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Snapshot is not available in California from all agents. Special thanks, as always, to our program's co-founder, Mr. Tori Malatia, who insists,
I'm the guy from the airport.
I'm Eric Glass. Back next week with more stories of This American Life.
Support for This American Life on KPR comes from the Dole Institute of Politics. Dole fellow Joni Wickham moderates bipartisan consensus building with Kansas State Representatives Laura Williams and Brandon Woodard on October 8th at 4 p.m. More at doleinstitute.org. And the University of Kansas, serving Kansas and the world through social and behavioral approaches to developmental disability research. Information about research at KU is at ku.edu. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, KANQ Chanute, and always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Imagine a revolutionary construction project going on in the ground beneath your feet, one done totally in secret. Today on KPR Presents, the story of New York City's secret subway. I'm Kay McIntyre, Matthew Algio.